Welcome to the Senate Education Workforce Committee. It is 3:10. We are late again today. I just want to let you know that all of us are on all these committees. I serve on a committee right until 3 o'clock, and this week is really hectic. We have members coming in and out because they have bills up in other committees, and so don't get alarmed if you see people leaving and coming and going. And I have my staff bringing me something so I don't hurt my university. But I do want to welcome all of the Oregon State folks here today. I am doing this in your honor, but I am also a duck. So I'm sorry, I've got to at least show my colors. So there we go. But we are an equal opportunity education committee. It's just I'm a graduate of the University of Oregon. But I appreciate all of you Oregon State folks here today. How many of you are you Beavers? Raise your hands. Awesome. Very good to see you all. I can tell some of you because you're very bright orange. Welcome. We have a couple of rules in our committee if you haven't been here before. Number one is if you have a cell phone, it goes off or it goes on vibrate, or you'll be writing a check to the Common School Fund.
It's up to $1,900.
$1,900, though we take about 1% of that. So that is because we just don't want to hear a cell phone ringing when people are testifying. Second rule, which isn't a rule, it's just if you want to testify, it is a rule, you have to sign up over here on the sign-up sheet. So with that, we can get started. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 416, and Ms. Taylor will tell us about that while Senator Metzger comes forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as printed, Senate Bill 416 would have prohibited the U of O and LSU from participating in the BCS series, Bowl Championship Series, on or after July 1st, 2008. However, we have the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments from Senator Metzger, and I'm sure that he would be willing to explain those to you. However, in your packet, I'd like to note that we do have an email correspondence from Tex Winter that was sent to us this afternoon.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. And Senator Metzger, I'm looking at the sign-up sheet, and Benny Beaver is signed up to testify.
I don't want to take Benny on. I've seen him in action before.
I didn't think you would, so I will let you sit at the dais by yourself and introduce yourself and take it away.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26, and here to discuss the amendments to Senate Bill 416. Senate Bill 416 addresses the issue of the values we expect our university system to embrace. It says quite simply that members of the Oregon University system should establish clear and comprehensive standards of conduct and consequences for that conduct. Importantly, those consequences need to be consistently applied throughout the university community. The bill simply requires each university to establish policies dealing with criminal conduct and consistently apply those policies to all students who participate in intercollegiate football. Moreover, it establishes minimum sanctions for those individuals charged with serious felony crimes of assault or crimes dealing with possession or distribution of controlled substances and the crime of driving under the influence of intoxicants, especially if that crime results in the injury to another person. On its face, the evidence for agreement is prima facie. But in reality, consistent standards are not applied. While recent incidents involving the Oregon State football team, including today's conviction in Benton County Circuit Court of a member of the OSU team on charges of assault, have spurred this action, I want to make it clear that this is an issue that is of import to all members of the Oregon University system, and none are immune from the requirements put forth in this legislation. Allow me, Madam Chair, to answer a few basic questions. Why should the legislature have an interest in directing universities to adopt and follow minimum standards of conduct? In reality, these circumstances are avoidable whenever possible. They become a part of law when those arms of state government, including the Oregon University system, fail to take a leadership role or take clear and decisive, and I want to emphasize decisive, action. In fact, Madam Chair, there are at least three of the bills that you are dealing with today, important bills that establish other values for higher education that aren't required by this legislature, that we're going to consider making requirements for OUS because we think it's important, tuition and other issues, to value our university system. And you're going to be hearing those considerations because there has been a consideration by some folks that they haven't taken that leadership themselves. Indeed, students and student athletes far younger than the young adults of our university system, youngsters who have more of an excuse to say, I didn't know better, are often held to higher standards than we who have the privilege of participating in college athletics. And it's been a while since I did that. For example, just 2 weeks ago, this Senate, by a vote of 23-2, including the members of this committee, passed Senate Bill 6, That strictly prohibits school coaches and others from promoting, suggesting, or supplying performance-enhancing supplements to student-athletes. The conduct and the sanctions were directed by the legislature because of the failure of school coaches and others to adequately address the issue themselves. During the last few sessions, we have passed legislation requiring members of the Oregon University system to adopt alcohol and drug abuse policies. We've directed schools to adopt policies prohibiting harassment, intimidation, or bullying, and the sanctions associated. In fact, our public schools, a student who threatens harm or violence to another student requires administrators to consider immediately removing that student from the classroom. And further, a student who brings a weapon to school, just brings a weapon to school, requires immediate expulsion from school, not suspension from sports, not suspension from school, expulsion. In every instance, schools could have reached these conclusions themselves, but they did not. Second, why football and not other activities or sports? Well, as you know, colleagues, the laws of the Senate require mandated legislation must conform to the relating clause, and the available vehicle was relating to college football. But while this bill can only require schools to adopt standards of conduct for intercollegiate football, the reasonable and prudent man test clearly assumes that the university is expected to apply these standards universally throughout the campus community. The football programs would simply have the opportunity to set that school-wide standard. Colleagues, I've heard passionate communication from people, very passionate, on both sides of this legislation. But let's be clear. The best legislation is often that which does not have to go to the governor's desk for his signature, because it has helped activate fast and effective response from those impacted by it. I met with Coach Riley and others on Monday. We discussed openly the current issues and concerns. I hope and I do believe in the testimony that they will provide will indicate they understand the importance of swift and decisive action and are prepared to take leadership on this issue. It should not be forgotten that participation in intercollegiate athletics is a privilege. It's one afforded very few students. Young people look up to players and coaches to form and emulate their values. Madam Chair, I was at a career day at Damascus Middle School this morning talking to 8th graders, which is why I missed the first part of session, and one young man said his goal was to grow up and be like Mike Riley and coach the Oregon State Beavers. They do listen and watch what we do. While no one can control the conduct of others, we can clearly articulate our values by the rules of the game. On the field, the rules are clear. If the chain says we're 2 inches short on fourth down, it's first and 10 the other way. It is not the referee's discretion. If the foot is on the line, it doesn't matter if it's only a small portion of the foot, you're out of bounds. Rules should be clearly defined off the field as well. When we apply rules differently or indecisively in our intercollegiate athletic programs, we communicate to the rest of the university community our values. And in turn, the university conveys to the citizenry of the state and others its values. OSU is not alone in this issue. They simply are currently carrying the burden, and I appreciate that that burden today is uncomfortable. At the end of this season, Oregon State was arguably one of the best teams on the West Coast. They took over leadership of their destiny after a mid-season slump and set a standard of excellence on the field. Now, Madam Chair, they can seize the opportunity to take leadership of another issue, the one off the field, and set a standard for other universities in this state to achieve. I thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Metzger. And I appreciate that you recognize that this problem does not rest with Oregon State University alone.
Absolutely.
And it is unfortunate for them that they're in the spotlight right now because of the number of cases they've had. But it's the same with, we had a bill in this committee about sexual abuse, and the Salem Kaiser School District was spotlighted in this committee because of the egregious case they had here that was pretty well publicized, and so we were able to use that as an example to pass good legislation out of that committee. So, Senator, I suspect that that's what you're trying to do here and not spotlight the OSU.
Yeah, absolutely, Madam Chair, it's unfortunate. As you know, this is our deadline week for hearing bills, and this was your last committee, and I realized Oregon State Day was scheduled, and certainly that was coincidental. That's unfortunate, and I apologize for that. But on the other hand, it gives us all an opportunity, I think, to share and understand these issues and put them in context with the values that we care about our universities in a lot of ways. That here in the legislature, Madam Chair, we need to do more to support them, and I think in our co-chair's budget, we're working on doing that. And we need to be a partner together in the values that we emulate to others and from our universities.
Senator, I agree with you, and I would reiterate that this was purely accidental that this hearing got scheduled today just because of the getting the amendments drafted and getting it on the calendar, and we happen to be at OSU Day. But I do think it's an opportunity for OSU supporters to weigh in and see that their coaches and their staff at the university are going to take leadership as we're going to hear from them. I would ask you one other question. You know, the Portland Trailblazers have had a horrible history with less than good conduct. And I would say that it was the fans and it was the people in this community of the state who really cried out loudly enough for the Trailblazers to take that team, the coaching staff, and the administration of the team and turn it around. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I understand the pressure, and everybody in this room, especially the gentleman right behind me, understands it's unfair pressure that we put on coaches and players at the university level and certainly at the professional level. But you know, having said that, we still expect certain codes of conduct, which is why we're a fan, why we're a Beaver fan, why we're a Duck fan, why we're a Blazer fan. And you can do everything else, and if you don't have that identity and someone feels like you're representing their values, it's going to impact you. And I think we all understand that. It's an important issue.
Senator, also us, those of us who serve in the legislators must act as leaders as well and show that kind of conduct and not the bad kind of conduct, but we must set an example for the people of the state. And so I do think that's true. Anytime anyone is in a leadership role, they must set that example for the rest of the state, and it makes it a higher bar. But that's the price of being in a leadership role. So I appreciate that. Any member of the committee have a question? You are all very well outfitted today. I appreciate that. No questions? All right, Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Mike Riley and Bob DeCarolis. Did I pronounce that correctly? And then Benny will be our last guest testifier, but I don't even see Benny in the room. So, Coach, welcome. If you want to state your name, please.
Coach, how come you don't have a tie?
I've got my Beaver stuff on, Senator Morris. I'm Mike Riley, football coach at Oregon State, Senator Walker.
And I'm Bob DeCarolis, Director of Athletics at Oregon State. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. You should have a copy of my testimony and then two documents, one regarding our educational process and one regarding our disciplinary actions that we shared with you in previous meetings.
Okay, our staff is currently collating that, and it'll be up here in a moment, probably. Go ahead and testify while we wait.
Okay, thank you very much. Oregon State is concerned by the number of incidents that have recently thrust student-athletes, particularly football players, and criminal activity into the spotlight. To this end, I've announced that we've embarked on a 45-day review of all educational programs and disciplinary processes that would impact the lives of these students both on and off the field. Our new policies will ensure that the expectations of all our athletes are very clear. We intend to benchmark best practices in the Pac-10 and to make changes on our disciplinary system. We will build in accountability systems, and student-athletes will clearly understand that their athletic participation is a privilege, and it will come with clear expectations about character, academic performance, and leadership. Coach Riley and I are serious about making changes that hold our student-athletes to explicit standards. As promised, I will announce the specifics of the changes during the week of May 2nd, and Madam Chairman, you and the committee will receive a document that would outline all our new policies, new procedures, and would anticipate that you would review that and give us your thoughts on those.
Thank you.
I appreciate that the committee members see this as an issue that has an impact on the state. Coach Riley and I are taking responsibility for creating these new policies and procedures, not just for the football players and student-athletes, but for all the athletic department, to ensure that the changes will be across the board for all student-athletes who represent our university and our state. Oregon State University has had a long-standing and effective code of conduct for students in general. This system has been based on an educational focus that holds students accountable for their behavior. Currently, all students, including student-athletes, who have been involved in the university's code of conduct accountability process, experience a less than 1% repeat offender rate. Athletics is developing partner policies that hold all student-athletes to the accountability demanded of their public presence. Oregon State University is a proud member of the Pac-10, and we will be looking to our sister institutions for the best disciplinary and educational programs. Coach Riley has already clarified the rules for his student-athletes that are effective immediately. We will enhance our standards and work closely with the university's current systems, the judicial system, and independent team rules to ensure better compliance for all of our student-athletes. I'd like to take you then to the second document that would be entitled Action Items Regarding Disciplinary and Educational Process at Oregon State University Department of Athletics. There should be 5 bullet points in there. I'm not going to go down there in detail, but I will say that this is just the start of our educational process and looking at and reviewing those. I would think that, and we're about halfway through this process in the time frame, I would anticipate that there'll be a number of other initiatives that'll come out of this, particularly one that strikes me is getting Mothers Against Drunk Driving involved in this procedure, because most of the incidents that we've had so far has had to do with alcohol abuse. So I would think as we go through the process, there'll be more and more initiatives that come out of that. At the end of the day, we want to make an impact in the lives of students and get them to understand the ramifications of their actions. The second part of that page would list the committees that are involved and the individuals that are involved. And it's my understanding in your meeting on Monday that you had some ideas of additional participation in that, and we certainly welcome that and will comply with that. With that, I wanted to switch over to Coach Riley, who will talk about your third piece of paper there, your disciplinary actions.
Okay, before we do that, could I ask you a couple of questions?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Did I understand you, there is a code of conduct at your university, and so when someone is charged with an offense under the code of conduct, they must go through some programming, because you indicate they are less than 1% repeat offenders.
And I could have, if you'd like me, I could have Dan Schwab, as coordinator of that program at the university, speak to that in detail. But yes, there is a code of conduct.
Okay, and so my question arose from that is that you said athletics will adhere to that. Has your athletics program not had a code of conduct?
No, we have. Okay,
you
but the question is trying to, because you have 3 levels of codes of conduct. You have the athletic department level, then you have the student conduct review through the university process, and then you have, obviously, the legal system.
Okay.
And normally what would happen is that the athletic part from the disciplinary process would kick in first. Because, quite honestly, if we had to wait for the legal system, it would take a long, long time. Exactly. And so usually ours kicks in first, then as additional facts or as the legal system plays itself out, as the university code system plays itself out, there could be additional sanctions, or there could be sanctions based just from that governing body that would be on top of the things that athletics would have done.
Okay.
Ma'am.
Yes, Senator Morsett.
I may be called out of the room.
That's a cell phone. Big time.
Ooh, oh, yeah, all right.
Vicky Chamberlain.
Yeah, money.
Vicky, I'll ask you to make a contribution to the Common School Fund, and you know how to do that. All right, thank you.
I just want to say something before I may be called out of the room, and I talked to Coach Riley yesterday and said that, you know, that unfortunate things happen in the best of families. We you know, none of us are immune from having something go on in our family that we have no control over, but the important thing is how you deal with it. And I told him I was very satisfied with the way he's dealing with it, and I think you're doing the right thing. So I just wanted to say that.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Senator. And then the other question I had is, gentlemen, you and I talked on Monday about your table. And I expressed some concerns about the disciplinary actions in here that I didn't think they were strong enough. and I just wanted the committee to know that we had that discussion and that this is very preliminary, and that you are going to add some additional folks on the list of people who are reviewing this, because I indicated that I thought you should have some sexual assault support folks on there and some more student involvement, and you did agree to look at my suggestions and take those back to your work group, did you not?
Yes, ma'am, we can go with that.
Okay, I just wanted the committee to be aware of that. All right, thank you. Coach Riley.
Thank you very much, Senator Walker. I appreciate the chance to talk to you about these issues. We appreciate the fact that these are very, very important issues and are passionate about the heart of these things and what they're all about. And I want you to know that I take this part of my job very, very seriously. I'm in college athletics and at Oregon State for the total development of our student athletes. And I appreciate that fact to no end. When I hire football coaches on our staff, I take into their account their ability to coach football, but also their abilities to interact and be proactive with kids. And that's a big, big part of the reason for why I want a guy on our staff, so that we can have a number of people that are active with us. I want you to know that we have policies in place and have acted on each one of those and have had many incidents down the road that have been under the radar, so to speak, but that we have dealt with. And for each one of those cases, they've been dealt with swiftly. And the players on our football team know that we have rules and they know that we have guidelines and they know that there are consequences, and that will continue to be the case. These issues and all this that's going on have given us an opportunity to look, as Bob said, at our policies and what we're doing and hopefully strengthen them. We've had some very good discussions. I had good discussions with many of you on Monday and have taken some ideas, and that's part of education. That's part of looking at things and tweaking them and making them better all the time. That's what I do in my job on the football field, and that's what I try to do in our job in dealing with our players. We have a captive audience on the football field, and we have made great strides with our players concerning their behavior on the field, the taunting, the celebration, the unsportsmanlike conduct. We've taken control of that, and we feel great about our improvement there. We can do exactly the same thing off the field with our football team. Now, will we bump our knees and will we make mistakes? Yes. Mm-hmm. But we will deal with them. We will educate them. We have preventive measures in place. I think this has also given us an opportunity to be more integrated with our whole university and the resources that are there for our kids to grow, working with Dan Schwab, working with other members of our university, so our kids have a chance to be educated, to be counseled, and also to be disciplined. And I feel very good about that, as we have done. I feel personally in my heart the work that we've done has been for the betterment of those kids and how they've each been handled. Our team and structure knows the rules and knows there have been consequences. And we stress daily in our meetings very important qualities that are important to our team. Most of those things have to do with off the field behavior. We deal with something with 105 kids. We deal with something every day. We deal with hopefully not incidents like these, but missing class or being late, and there's consequences for all of that. And frankly, I take on the responsibility of going into a young man's home, talking to his parents, and talking to his parents about that young man coming out of our program with a degree as a better person and hopefully is the best player that he can be. So it's a well-rounded job, which I appreciate every day, and I appreciate the work that we get to do. And I want to assure you once again that we are on top of everything that our kids do. That's one of the beauties of Oregon State University, is that it is a place, a community with total involvement by the people at the university that play a role in these kids' life, and I'm proud of that. And another thing I'll have to say is I grew up in this state. And I know one of the things that we all want as citizens of Oregon, we want a football team that we're proud of, not only for the wins that are on the field, but as importantly, the behavior on and off the field. And we talk about that and work with our kids daily about that, because I want people, I want you to come to the games, and I want you to enjoy what you see and appreciate the work that's going on with our team. And we will continue to work very, very hard at getting this done.
Thank you, Coach. I noticed that you call them kids, and as you were saying that, I thought about it, because they are.
Mm-hmm.
They turn 18, and officially they become adults, but they're still kids. And all of us here have been to college. All of us here have had our share of whatever it is we did in college, admit it, even though you don't want to.
I don't want to admit all of it.
And, you know, but when they go into your program, you have a big job. You have a huge job to help shape these
Absolutely.
Kids into being successful adults. So there will be a few bumps along the way. These were pretty big bumps. And, you know, I appreciate Senator Metzger bringing this bill forward, not to embarrass you, but simply to shine a light on how important it is to remind us all that these kids are kids that need to grow into really good adults, and they take on a big role when they come into your program and set a huge example for the rest of us. There are so many young people out there who idolize these football players and basketball players, so it's important that they are the leaders that we expect them to be. I appreciate all of your explanations today, and I really appreciate that you'll come back with your committee's work on May 2nd so that we can see what you're doing. You could set an example for other universities in the system. Certainly, Oregon State, even though I graduated from the University of Oregon, it is a fine institution, and I attended a game recently as a guest of President Ray, and I wore, it wasn't quite orange, it was tangerine, but I got close. But, you know, it is a fine university, as all of them are in the system, and we all want to be proud. And when the Ducks don't make it in the Final Four, then I root for the Beavers, and, you know, likewise in football. So there you go. And Senator Cruz probably has a question, too.
No, not a question, Madam Chair, just a comment, because I can remember. And I did not go to Oregon State. I went to Willamette. But I can remember as a 17-year-old freshman on the football team, there were some extracurricular activities. And yes, there were. And you know, to expect a coach or a coaching staff to be monitoring these kids 24/7 is totally unrealistic. But to expect them to be able to deal with the consequences of action clearly are, you may have issues with this graph. I really don't, because I'm looking at somebody who's 17 and 18, away from home for the first time, and may find themselves in situations, and to have remedial ways to address it on the front end, I think, are totally appropriate. And you know, for minor in possession, for example, well, that happens even with non-athletes. I think this is a very good approach, and I appreciate that. And I would agree with the coach that most of the things they have to do, we never hear about. And they do monitor on a regular basis. And I have followed Coach Riley's career for a long time. And I think we would be hard-pressed to find a man with greater integrity than Coach Riley. And I'm glad that he's back. And I think your tight end, Mr. Newton, who's from Roseburg, should be an All-American this year. So.
Oh, now I see where you were going.
Well, he's good.
Well, Senator Cruz, just for the record, the concern I had was the DUII and the assault on a person. I felt that a second offense really should be suspension from the team rather than saving that for the third offense, because the first time you make a mistake, the second time you've made a choice to drive, and you take others' lives into your hands when you get behind a wheel. And then the other area of concern for me was assault on a person, and I wanted more more definitive work on that, because sexual assault, I have zero tolerance, absolutely zero tolerance for sexual assault. And so I wanted degrees of sexual assault defined and the discipline to reflect that accordingly.
That's a good, that's a very, very good point. Can I say that?
Yes.
Senator Locke, we have already talked about that, and that's not, as you know, on a piece of paper, you can't be all-inclusive,
right.
But we realize and have talked about that, that there are different degrees of almost everything that's on that sheet that we have to deal with, and we'll take that advice.
Great. Thank you. Senator Starr, do you have a comment?
Well, I can't let this opportunity go by. I feel that student athletics is probably the best proving ground for developing leadership, character, citizenship, those qualities that are so important to a citizen who makes a contribution. And I so appreciate the good coaches that we've had, and certainly Mike Riley. I've not met before, but I followed his career, and as Senator Cruz has said, I feel like that your heart is for developing that student into a well-rounded individual, and I commend you. I commend all the student athletes, and thank you for your service to our students and to our state.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. And we really appreciate you coming in. It took courage to come in front of us, and I appreciate that. And I really have enjoyed visiting with you. I look forward to hearing back from you in May. I'm just going to hold this bill in abeyance until we hear back from you. And we look forward to seeing a continued successful football program and other sports programs at OSU, and seeing you graduate all those wonderful kids who grow into great adults.
Thank you very much.
And thank all of you OSU supporters and fans who are in the room. We are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 416. Okay. Thank you, Mike. Okay. If anyone's in the overflow room for Senate Bill 300, that was the bill we were going to hear next. So I will make that announcement. Harvey's here. You just walked in. Is there something you can kick out real quick?
Yeah, we can do
this. Really?
We could start on 342, which is...
Who's signed up for that?
We could start on 642, which is...
We're going to hold off on Senate Bill 300. We're waiting for Senator Gordley. So I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 643 at this time. Mr. Wyckoff, are you prepared to go forward? You have a sign-up sheet?
We're getting it.
Okay.
Madam Chairman,
Senator Gordley has just arrived. So, Mr. Wyckoff, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 643. And you will kindly step aside. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 300. Senator Gordley, if you'll come forward while Ms. Taylor talks about the bill. And Harvey Matthews, And I've got three seats, so bring your three people. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 300 was first heard on the 16th of February. At that time, we heard the original bill, which creates the expanded options program for students attending public schools in grades 11 and 12 who are 16 and older, and allows them to enroll in post-secondary courses for credit at eligible post-secondary institutions. However, at that time, we heard that a work group was going to be formed, and indeed it did, and they did some great work, and you have the you should have the Dash 2 amendment that was provided by Senator Gordon's office, and I know that you have some witnesses here who want to testify on that. This measure has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Gosh, February 16th was a long time ago. You folks have been at it hot and heavy since then, and we only have a Dash 2. That's pretty good. So, Senator Gordley, take it away.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Avelle Gordley, and I represent Senate District 23, Northeast and Southeast Portland. And Senator Walker, I also expect Representative Dallin to come in at some moment. He wanted to join me and express his support for Senate Bill 300 as well.
He was here and he left, but if he comes back, we'll put him up here.
All right.
Thank you.
Senator Walker and members of the committee, I thank you for hearing Senate Bill 300. And I want to express my deep appreciation to the members of the work group who saw this bill as an opportunity to extend their efforts to create a seamless system connecting Oregon high school students with institutions of higher learning. The work group effort, chaired by Harvey Matthews of Associated Oregon Industries and Chuck Bennett of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, will provide additional opportunities for 16 and 17-year-old students to become successful in school. Members of the work group included representatives from, and if they are here, and I hope that they'll stand as I name the organizations they represent.
Okay, please feel free to do that.
The Oregon University System, the Oregon Community College Association, Associated Oregon Industries, the Confederation of School Administrators, the Oregon Community College and Workforce Development, that office, the Oregon School Boards Association, the Oregon Department of Education, the Oregon Education Association, two parent volunteers, and my remarkable legislative aide, Sean Cruz. All of these good folks work together to agree upon the details of what will constitute Oregon's Expanded Options Program. Senate Bill 300 offers Oregon students in grades 11 or 12 who are 16 years or older additional options to complete or continue their education, to earn concurrent high school and college credits, and to gain early entry into post-secondary education. As Portland Community College Cascade Campus President Algie Gatewood put it, and I don't know if you've met President Gatewood or not, but you sure need to create an opportunity. He's quite a champion. He said that this kind of opportunity gets students hooked on college early. And so Senate Bill 300 promotes and supports existing accelerated college credit programs and supports the development of new programs that are unique to a community's secondary and post-secondary relationships and resources. This bill provides public funding to the eligible post-secondary institutions for educational services to eligible students to offset the cost of tuition, fees, textbooks, and necessary equipment. The bill provides an important tool to keep students from dropping out and to reach those who have already dropped out, ensuring that students in all of our Oregon school districts have access to some form of meaningful accelerated learning opportunity. No one involved in the discussions believed that this bill would effectively address every possible individual scenario for students, parents, or schools. But Senate Bill 300 provides a meaningful building point and clearly moves our educational system forward with emphasis, Madam Chair, on creating more of a system of opportunity. Each of the work group participants contributed meaningfully to the final product, and when the bill is printed, each participant will be able to take satisfaction in that some, if not all, of their ideas are included. I want to take this opportunity to thank all of the participants, and particularly Mr. Matthews, for all of the hard work and creative ideas, and for finding a collective way to put students first. Senate Bill 300 will provide students and schools with new tools for success. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would just add again that Representative Dallum and I have been in conversation about the expanded options concept and opportunity that we want to see created for students.
And he has just arrived, Senator.
Good afternoon, friend. And what I was going to say is that the good representative has agreed to join me in co-sponsoring Senate Bill 300, and he looks forward to the opportunity to shepherd this bill along its path in the House. I'll let him say more about that.
Thank you very much, Senator Gordley. Representative Dallum, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chairman Margaret. Thank you, committee. I think Senator Gordley has spoken very eloquent for me. Both her and I have started bills that were very similar in the beginning. They're nothing alike right now. The Senate side went to work, put together a committee, and they have worked hard to make Senate Bill 300 as movable as it can be. I have a House Bill 2919 that started with the exact same language. As I said, they don't look alike now. But both the senator and I are going to nurture and defend this bill through both sides. So I would ask you to pass Senate Bill 300 out of committee. And if it does well here, we'll protect it when it gets to the other side.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Senator.
I appreciate that. Okay. Tricia or Harvey, who wants to go next?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association.
Yeah,
that's all right.
Call you, Tricia.
That's
wondering.
Okay. That's an honor.
I know exactly who you are because I see you every day. But excuse me. I think I had Tricia Smith on my mind because we have a bill up later.
That's
sorry.
Quite all right. Committee members, we, as you may remember, initially had some reluctance and some issues with respect to this bill. And I think we all in the state of Oregon owe a huge debt of gratitude to Senator Gordley, to her staff, to Harvey Matthews, who led us all through some, as we plowed through every line of this bill together, and to all of the folks who worked on this work group who did just a masterful job. They were thoughtful, intelligent, creative. Everything you've heard today, in my 15 years in the building, I can't think of another time where I've been on a work group that's been this productive, this flexible, this enjoyable to work with. So what I'm here to tell you is that we wholeheartedly endorse this version of the bill and are happy to support it and ask you to do so as well. Thank you.
Ms. Wimmer Whalen, that is music to my ears to hear that come from you. I'm very pleased to hear that, and I'm very pleased that you were involved in the work group. And Mr. Matthews does deserve a lot of credit. We're going to hear from him next, and I did want to let the committee know he kept me apprised of all the amendments, all the meetings, all the progress by email, and I appreciate that kind of communication with the chair of a committee. So thank you, Mr. Matthews, and why don't you tell us about what you have on your mind?
Well, I want to thank you, Senator Walker. We had this up for work session last week, and we were just putting the final touches on it, and I appreciate your delaying until everything was right, and that's why we just have this dash two amendment that we all agree on. Senator Gordley, I want to also thank you for providing leadership, and, you know, there's a dozen people in the work group, each one of whom stepped forward at a critical time and provided creative solutions to what would have been impasses. If I may go through the bill very quickly and talk through the amendments that are in the Dash 2 amendments and talk about why we made those amendments. In Section 1, we're defining topics. We included accelerated college credit programs and made a definition for that in there. Actually, Cindy Hunt did, of course. She did a wonderful job of that.
Isn't she great?
Yeah, there's nobody better. We also defined at-risk students as those on free and reduced lunch. That was at the request of the parents that were in the group. That is able to be amended by the Department of Education should the department come up by rule with a better definition for at-risk students.
Mm-hmm.
In Section 2, we added the goal that was really put forward by Senator Gordley of creating a seamless education system. And this bill, I think, does just that. It has the opportunity to lower dropout rates for students, increase college attendance by getting them hooked on college early, and decrease college costs for families. We also added the goal of promoting and supporting existing programs and encouraging the development of new programs. And Salam Noor from the Department of Education really helped guide us in that amendment. In Section 3, we added an appeal process for students who wish to take a duplicative course. I thought that was an excellent amendment put forward by the parents involved with the group. We created a fixed timeline for that appeal, also brought forward by the parents, and we agreed to a fix that students must maintain academic progress to be eligible for this program. That wasn't in the previous bill.
Okay.
Section 4 remained unchanged. Section 5, we added that all high school students are now notified. In the previous bill, it just talked about 16-year-old plus. But we thought it would be a good idea to have students, as they entered high school, to understand they have several options, and those options include this expanded options bill. And we also, as I mentioned earlier, defined at-risk students and how to reach out to them. Section 6 remained unchanged. Section 7 added an advisory support team, and we defined that more clearly as a student, their parent or guardian, and we wanted to include a professional, either a teacher or counselor in that group to help that student figure out how to include these expanded options within their high school curriculum. In Section 8, we made an attempt to not allow some fifth-year programs take advantage of perhaps some additional funding that this bill could open up, and Salam Noor again helped us with that issue. And Section 10 is the real heart of the discussion. That's the financing issue that has always doomed this bill in the past. And what was very creatively done by our university system people and our community college folks and John Marshall with school boards and Lori was to develop a fair and equitable distribution method there. And it says a minimum of 50% of the school district's general purpose grant per student per extended ADNW, roughly $2,200 to $2,600 in that Section 10 sub 3B is going to be expended on these programs unless these programs are present a undue financial hardship for the school district, which Lori came up with. I thought that was an excellent suggestion.
Good suggestion.
And we also were able to grandfather in existing programs. If a school district already has good programs with their community college or university partners, then they are allowed to seek a waiver from this as well. Sections 11 through 16 remained unchanged. Section 17 is where they talk about small high schools, and we had quite a discussion about that. I think there's a concern there, especially with the parent members, that some of the smaller high schools would be limited here in the credit hours they would give students. So I wanted to flag that for you. We did add in there a provision that schools may exceed these credit hour caps should they so choose. And again, encouraging schools to develop these relationships with their post-secondary partners. In Section 18, we did delete the sunset of the small high school limit. We thought that instead, in that next session, we talked about a report that the Department of Education would give to the education committees and also the joint boards. And in that report that the Department of Education will produce, they will specifically mention the small high schools, the usage, and several other things that will help the legislature and the education community determine if we need to massage this bill in the future. And we all agree that, you know, this is a first step, mm-hmm. and it will need to be have some feedback loops with good data.
Well, Mr. Matthews, I know that Senator Wardley, I think, has worked on this bill for four sessions.
Yes.
So,
but the concept has, Madam Chair, has been around for at least 10 years, mm-hmm. in this legislative process. Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a very good first step, and we likely will have to revisit it, but you've made great strides. Did you have a comment, Senator?
Madam Chair, I remember when Harvey was just a little kid in the speaker's office.
Aw.
I'm
going
to cry.
Okay, were you completed with your analysis of the amendment, Mr. Matthews?
We changed the grandfathering section, and we added a timeline for the reports that the Department of Education would give us. Otherwise, it remains as written, except for those amendments.
Okay.
And the process was great. The people on the work committee were great, and we just are looking forward to the next challenge to work together and figure out the next solution.
Senator Wardley, did you have any parting comments?
Madam Chair, if I may, I would like to thank your committee administrator, Marjorie Taylor, for all of her hard work.
She's so wonderful, isn't she?
Well, she's an example of the great staff, you know, the professional staff that we have working to support us in this building. Just really phenomenal. And I want to thank you for the quality of communication that you've been having with my office and with John Cruz. Thank you very much.
Yes, we had to smile when Ms. Wimmer Whalen said this was the first time in 15 years she's worked on such a productive work group, because we had an ESP work group that was very productive as well. It was chaired by Senator Cruz, and I think part of that goes to the good skills of Ms. Taylor. She's very good at what she does. Senator Starr, did you have any questions or comments?
I commend them for their work, and I think that this adds to the opportunities for students. The student at risk that I see that may be missed in this is the one who excels and is bored with school. And there are opportunities for that student. I hope they are aware of them. But I'm afraid we lose too many bright students who have lost interest because they're not being challenged. And so that's a concern of mine. But this is great work, and I'd like to see this bill move on so it can make its way through the process.
Madam Chair, if I may address Senator Starr's comment, because mm-hmm. it's a very important one, and thank you for drawing that out, Senator Starr. There is a requirement in the bill, a reporting requirement through the Department of Education, where districts would have to report the number of talented and gifted students, for example, who participate in these programs. But again, the intent also is to make the program the option available to all students. And I hope that it addresses somewhat the concern that you're raising.
Thank you.
And we have, Senator Gourley, there are two folks signed up to testify who I think are probably going to address that issue. I think they have some concerns about it. But thank you. Thank all of you.
Thank you.
Very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Margaret DeLay and Deborah Andrews, can you come forward, please? Oh, all right. Thank you. That's what they did. I'm usually pretty good about that, but thanks, Charles. Kick me if I forget. All right. I've been reminded by my vice chair that I forgot to ask two people of that last group to identify themselves. So if you could do that, please. And as I was looking through my materials, I see the testimony, written testimony we had of Ms. Andrews before in February. So, all right. Well, either of you who wishes to start, go ahead.
Can I start? Okay. Good morning, Chair Walker. My name is Margaret DeVacy. I'm a Portland area parent and a former chair of the Portland School District's Talented and Gifted Advisory Committee. I was somewhat surprised to discover that I was on the work group, actually, and I hope I'm not committing a breach of etiquette here by commenting on some of the amendments that work group made. I do want to emphasize that I do support very strongly the concept behind Senate Bill 300, and I hope it will go forward. However, I'm concerned about what has happened with some of the amendments, and I'd like to share that with you.
Okay.
I'd like to begin by asking if you can think of an Oregon student under the age of 18 who has no right to learn in school. I have handed out to you data from Portland Public Schools about the extent to which our students, divided by ability, are in fact learning. Can you hear me? Is this live?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are in fact learning in school. And you will see that high school students who exceed benchmarks make almost no gains in reading and no gains at all in math. I hope that your answer will be that there are no children who don't deserve to learn in school, that every child has a right to learn. And I'd like to also point out that this is the philosophy that has guided Oregon law. I won't recite them here. There is no exemption from these rules for students who happen to be high achievers, nor should there be, even though the data shows that these high achievers are not necessarily learning in our schools today. Many of these children are being warehoused. They are not receiving appropriate instruction required by state law. And this wastes their minds. It hurts them socially and emotionally, which is my greatest concern as a mother. And it's also a colossal waste of our taxpayer dollars to keep children in school when they aren't learning there. Other states, including Washington State, do a better job of providing access to more challenging curriculum. In particular, Running Start, the Washington State program, saves families and taxpayers $57 million a year. Do we here in Oregon have that kind of money to waste? In Washington, the number of students taking AP classes has risen, not fallen, since the Running Start program began. Early college programs do not undermine advanced placement classes, as was claimed in an earlier hearing here. I had hoped that Senate Bill 300 would create a similar program here in Oregon. However, some of these amendments have drastically limited the responsibilities of school districts and the opportunities for students that they'll receive under this bill. So I'd like to just share with you some of my major concerns about the bill. I'd also like to say that we didn't have a chance to read the amendments until today. They didn't come up. So I'm basing this on the discussions we had in the work group. There are a couple of other drafting issues with some of the amendments that I saw when I went over them today in the hearing room. First, the bill limits participation to students 16 and over. We need an appeal process for younger students, and I thought we'd agreed on this in the work committee. It was overturned at the last minute. Did you know that both Martin Luther King and Condoleezza Rice graduated from high school at the age of 15? Participants in the services provided under Senate Bill 300 do not need to go to a college campus. The bill does include for distance learning and dual credit classes taught in a high school. So I can't see any real argument from barring younger students from participating in these classes if they're ready and prepared to take them. Second, the bill limits the number of credits a high school must provide. This is not a small school amendment. The cap was written for schools of 1,000, but the bill directs that the number of students under the cap would be prorated depending on the size of the high school. So a larger high school would have a larger cap, but it would still be the equivalent of 330 credit hours for a student in a small school of 1,000. 330 credit hours amounts to approximately 9 full-time enrollments in a college program. The original bill sunsetted those caps in 2009. The amended bill you have keeps those caps forever. It removed the sunset. And I don't understand why we would offer college-level classes to 9 students in a school and then tell a 10th equally well-prepared student that they couldn't participate because they weren't there were other 9 students had taken those slots. In fact, I can't understand why we would want to deprive any public school student of the chance to take appropriate classes at their level of learning. Setting limits on the number of well-educated students in our workforce and in our state is really not in anyone's interest, and it's certainly not in the taxpayers' interest to pay taxes to warehouse students when they're not learning. Finally, a section has been added that states school districts that offer dual credit tech prep. I'm sorry, I'm reading this from the amendments that we wrote in the work group. Mm-hmm. The language in the draft amendment that I saw this afternoon is slightly different, so I'm going to read you what I had when I worked on this because the language is important. School districts that offer dual credit tech prep, advanced placement, international baccalaureate, and other accelerated learning programs are exempt from the financial obligations of this act. If they serve all qualified applicants and there are no charges to students who qualify for free and reduced lunch programs. Notice that that is a district exemption. So if a class is offered anywhere in a district, the district could apply for the exemption, even if it's not convenient. Sorry, Senator Morissette, did you wish me to...
I'm sorry.
The school district can apply for an exemption if it meets any of those criteria anywhere in the district, even if the class is available in one school all the way across the district and it's difficult for the student to work out transportation arrangements to take advantage of it. I find this section rather confusing and ambiguous. I think there may well be litigation or appeals over it. And I'm concerned that since virtually every school district in the state now offers a program of this kind to some students, that we may find that every school district or the vast majority of them will be exempted from the provisions of Senate Bill 300. In closing, if students are qualified and they're ready for college-level work, they should be allowed to take college-level classes, even if there are more than 9 of them in a given school, and even if they're younger than 16. To do anything else, simply waste their time and our money. And I'd like to ask if you have any questions.
I don't. Ms. DeLacy, I did get an email from you recently, and I knew about your concerns. And I'm sorry you didn't get the amendments till today. I know that Mr. Matthews has been very good about submitting draft language out to the email work group.
Mr. Matthews sent us the amendments that we had agreed to,
mm-hmm.
but my understanding is that they didn't come up from the LC office until today, mm-hmm. which is why I wasn't able to review the exact language until this afternoon.
All right. Thank you. Ms. Andrews.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, thank you for your time today and thank you for hearing Senate Bill 300. I very much appreciate the opportunity to have been a part of that work group and talk about student learning and challenging students. The effect of this bill is designed to result in a focus on individual learning, encourage and allow students to reach higher than is traditional in our schools, facilitate students accomplishing much more than many dreamed possible, and highlight the need for education to be considered a seamless K-16 endeavor. I'm very glad that this bill has been introduced. I'm concerned about the age limit. I would really like to see an appeal process for those students that are younger than 16 to have the possibility of this opportunity. I see this bill as a way for Oregon schools to reach students that are historically underrepresented in talented and gifted programs or programs of challenge. I see this as a real vehicle to do that. I'm concerned that Section 10, subsection 3, that is on page 8, B, may limit those opportunities for whom this bill is designed by eliminating most school districts in this state. I think it's imperative that Section 18, in its entirety, on page 12, be implemented to safeguard that that not happen, that school districts do not receive that waiver and then not participate and serve those underrepresented students. I think Section 18 is very important, that the Oregon Department of Education look at those concerns and report back to you and let you know how SB 300 is being implemented, if it is being implemented as it was intended. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and I've been reminded that I didn't ask you to state your name for the
record. I'm sorry, and thank you for reminding me. My name is Deb Andrews. I'm parent, and I'm from Portland.
Thank you, Ms. Andrews. Any questions from the committee? Senator Starr, any questions? All right. Well, thank you, ladies. We appreciate your testimony and your concerns. I would say we're going to move this bill today. This bill, as Mr. Matthews said, may probably have to come back and work on it in the future, but this has been 10 years in the making. This is a big step. It's a big step and a small step both, and I think it's been vetted pretty good.
Yes.
I know your concerns, and hopefully we can deal with those in the future, but we can't do that now.
Thank you, and I think Section 18 will help us with that.
I think so, too. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much, Senator Walker.
All right, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 300. I'm opening a work session on Senate Bill 300. Senator Starr.
Madam Chair, I move the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 300.
Senator Starr moves the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 300. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 300 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 300 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? Well, I look forward to seeing that down there. So ordered, it's on its way. And again, thank you, Mr. Matthews, and your work group for all your work. Okay. Where are we headed next? I need to announce that Senate Bill closed work session on Senate Bill 300. Senate Bill 719 is off the calendar. I hope no one's been sitting here waiting on that. That actually is my bill, and Representative Flores, we're going to hold that bill and continue to work on that. So that is not going to be heard today. This one next? Okay, we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 637. Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair, somewhere in my paperwork I have a summary about 637. Lo and behold, there it is.
Okay,
so Senate Bill 637 as printed would have established the multi-ethnic student loan program to provide educational loans to minority students who agree to teach in Oregon school districts. However, we have the -3 amendment from Senator Deckard's office. I'm sure he wants to speak to that, which establishes the multicultural student loan program and various other provisions of the measure. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Oh, we seem to have a lot of those referrals to Ways and Means. Okay, Senator Deckard, you're on deck. To state your name, please. You are not the little boy. No one will get that joke unless they were in judiciary today. But.
And I made it on myself, so I deserve any flack that I get.
You did. I'm going to turn that in for the signy die tape, so we can live with that forever.
Oh, boy. I bet you I do. Madam Chair, Ryan Deckard, State Senator from Beaverton.
here is, and Senate Bill 637 comes to you, and I'll just give you a brief 2 or 3 minute, but Senator Gordley and I were invited to a meeting, and we're hoping to get this down to Ways and Means, frankly, and see if we can get, can compete. But we went to a meeting at the new Dean of Education at Lewis and Clark's office, and he walked us through two statistics, and I think there were statistics that would get our attention. One was, we looked at the demographics of today's students, and I know you had a presentation in this committee, Madam Chair, about that very issue. We have a very changing demographic of who is in our schools today. And then we did a separate side-by-side demographic of here's what our teaching force is going to look like in the School of Education across the state who are training our future teachers. And we have an issue. We have a student population that is diversifying by the moment, and we have a teaching core that is actually stratifying at that same very time. And so we do a lot of conversation about the achievement gap, and this is one issue that I think addresses the achievement gap, because I think there is no greater goal that we could have than to have a few role models and a few teachers that actually reflect the diversity of the student body. And so what you see before you is one antidote to that, a growing disparity between diversity of students and diversity of teachers, because what we're trying to do, and I'm told at least that we have a opportunity in the Ways and Means process, because the price tag on this is low, is entice a more multi-ethnic teaching corps by going at students in Oregon and providing some compensation or some financial advantage to them to actually go into education and diversify those future teachers. And I can go on at length and length if you want, but I think you have a full agenda, and you have my written testimony before you. You see the income requirements, that you have to be below 60% of the state median income. You have to be first generation to attend an institution of higher education, speak English as a second language, and this helps you actually, if you want to be a teacher and you fit the criteria, actually achieve a higher education. So, Madam Chair, I do think if we do this, it would be, we talk about significant things we can do, and I actually think it would mark the significant box of something that we could do that would really benefit both students that are in K through 12 and help a lot of multi-ethnic students who actually want to be teachers actually get to go to the School of Education and diversify our future teachers.
Thank you, Senator Deckert. I don't think there's any questions. We're going to hear from the regular folks that will come up behind you. I'd like to hear from Yvette Weber Davis, Vicki Chamberlain, and Pat Burke.
Good afternoon, Chair Walker and members of the committee. I'm Yvette Weber Davis from the Oregon University System Chancellor's Office. And I would like to offer support on behalf of the Oregon University System for Senate Bill 637, the Dash 2 amendments. And I believe I heard you mention Dash 3 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments were the latest that we had. Is that correct?
No, we have a Dash 3.
You have Dash 3.
Okay. Are you aware of a Dash 3?
No.
No?
No.
I haven't.
We'll get you one of those.
Okay.
Do you want to have a chance to look at those while someone else testifies at the table?
That would be great for me.
Okay. Have you all seen that?
I have.
You have. Okay. Pat Burke has seen that.
Okay, I'm sorry. Marjorie says that it adds community colleges in the Dash 3 amendment.
Okay. So that doesn't require a great deal of time for you to review?
No.
Okay.
It was quick.
Well, there
thank
you go.
You.
Let's finish your testimony then.
Okay. Thank you for your efforts to support Oregon's teacher workforce and also to provide expanded opportunities to potential educators. As you know, we face multiple challenges within the arena of meeting current and future educational needs for the state. The State Board of Higher Education has listed several priorities for our university system. Two of those refer to access to a college degree and affordability of a college education. Senate Bill 637 supports these areas as amended, especially through the provision of enhanced access and affordability opportunities for students. This bill provides educational outreach and support to students who might otherwise not have the resources to pursue careers as educators. The provisions of the bill will also assist to further enhance the pool of educators that are prepared in Oregon's colleges and schools of education. So we thank you for this bill, and as I mentioned earlier, as far as I can tell, the Dash 3 amendments reflect what we came to support in Dash 2.
Thank you very much. And it's good to see you in front of our committee again.
It's been a while.
We had a great presentation by you earlier this year, so thank you. Ms. Chamberlain, state your name and who you're with, and that you will never turn your cell phone on again in committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, please accept Vicki Chamberlain, the Director of Teacher Standards and Practice, humbly asking you to forgive me. I sincerely thought that phone was dead and didn't check it. My apologies, and I will pay the fine if you'll tell me how much it is.
$1,900.
Oh. Oh my God.
No.
It's escalated over time.
So. Yeah, we just throw those numbers about. Just a modest contribution to the Common School Fund would be appreciated.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I had the great experience of being able to work with Senator Decker's staff and look at this before the bill was printed and make some suggestions, which they adopted wholeheartedly. And we support the bill. The addition, frankly, though, here at the last minute of community colleges does raise a slight problem. The Teacher Standards and Practices isn't authorized to approve education programs in community colleges, and one of the co-requirements here is that they're enrolled in a teacher education program to become a teacher. And the only way I think we can make this work is if we have some language that would allow us to say, so long as the community college is working in partnership with a higher ed teacher education program, which actually happens. We do have those. I know that Chemeketa and Western Oregon and other folks have worked in great partnerships on these programs, but I think the Student Scholarship Commission, by the way the bill is written, would not be able to loan money to someone in a community college because they wouldn't be enrolled in an approved teacher education program. So if we could figure out how to smooth out that wrinkle, I think other than that, we think it's a fabulous bill. It's a great opportunity, and I do think it will help us improve our numbers of multicultural people and people who meet these things and are sensitive to the needs of multicultural children. So thank you.
Okay, great. I think we can smooth that little wrinkle out in Ways and Means, since
great.
I'm on that committee. I'll just impart that information. Okay. Mr. Burke?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For your record, I'm Pat Burke, the Chief Policy Officer with the Department of Education. I, too, am here to speak in support of Senate Bill 637 as amended. My comments are perhaps a little bit more general. We have just recently seen the most recent breakdown of the new teachers. We have a responsibility, the Department of Education and the Oregon University System, to prepare a regular report for the legislature on teacher diversity in the state. It's part of the Minority Teacher Act of, I believe, 1999 session. And the numbers, although they are increasing, that's the good news. The bad news is that we are still at around 5 to 5.5% ethnic minorities in our workforce. Another piece of good news is the largest increases we are seeing are among Latino and bilingual teachers. That also is good news. However, the student ratio is still at 23% of total student population and growing every year, as Senator Deckert mentioned in his testimony. So what we see is a growing gap between teacher ethnicity and student ethnicity. Now, why is that important? Obviously, the first thing you want are good teachers, regardless of ethnicity. You want high-quality teachers well-prepared for Oregon classrooms. Having said that as a given, we also know that students do well in an environment where they see themselves reflected, where they feel that their culture and language and ethnicity, their families are made to feel welcome in the school, and part of that creating a positive climate is whether or not I see anyone like myself in the school. We are working with the university partners in issues related to preparing teachers to work effectively in multicultural classrooms. Obviously, if the teacher it represents a minority group, that's a major step toward creating that kind of positive environment in the classroom. This restores commitments that were made early on in something called the Oregon Teacher Corps Act and later in the Minority Teacher Act, where there were funds available for loan forgiveness. This restores that opportunity, and what I particularly like about the bill is the deferral clauses related to being able to work in high-need districts that really goes a long way to helping us get a diverse workforce into the schools that could benefit from it the most. So thank you for letting me testify, Madam Chair. We certainly strongly support this bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Burke. And we just had a discussion about the Oregon Teacher Corps Act in
Thanks.
Ways and Means this morning.
Yes.
So how handy.
Yes.
I just over and over again I have to say how pleased I am that the Senate President did this, put a few of us on the policy, as chair of policy committees on our corresponding Ways and Means Committee. It's really been a very effective system, I think. Any questions from the committee? Okay, well, thank you very much for your testimony and your presence in our committee. We have two others signed up to testify, Key Jackson and Margie Lowe. You could come forward, please. And, colleagues, we were going to go till 6 o'clock tonight. We had, or whenever we get done, because this is our really last big push, and we had notified everyone's office of that, so we hope it doesn't take that long. All right, someone go first and state your name, please.
Chair Walker and members of the Senate Education and Workforce Committee, for the record, my name is Key Jackson, and I'm a student at Western Oregon University. I'm here today as a board member for the Oregon Students of Color Coalition to support Senate Bill 637 with the -3 amendments. OSOC is a statewide coalition that works to represent students of color in post-secondary education. Senate Bill 637 creates a multicultural student-to-teacher loan program within the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. The loan program will provide education loans to students who agree to teach in Oregon schools and come from low-income families. Our first-generation students speak a second language. Our student parents attended high school in low-income areas, or may enhance the cultural diversity of Oregon schools. A percentage of the loan will be forgiven each year that the student teaches in Oregon. The maximum loan is $7,500 over 3 years of post-secondary education. If the student does not teach in Oregon, they will be required to repay the loan with interest. Students will be nominated for the loan program by the college and must be enrolled in a teacher licensure program, have at least a 2.5 grade average, and agree to teach in Oregon for the length of time necessary to complete the forgiveness of the loan. OSOC supports Senate Bill 637 because it will help diversify our education system in Oregon. While tuition has been increasing at community colleges and public universities, college has become more out of reach for many students, especially low-income and first-generation students. For the students that do go to college, the debt load after graduating prevents them from taking public service jobs. This bill would allow financial incentives for students to go into teaching in essential public service. This bill will expand opportunities to go into teaching for low-income students and students of color, populations that are already underrepresented in our colleges as teachers in our primary and secondary education. Teachers of color represent 9% of teachers nationwide, while 40% of the student population is of color. In Oregon, 20% of the student population is of color, and they need to see teachers that come from their culture and speak their language. Low-income students that do find the means to afford college are less likely to become teachers because of their loan debt and the lure of other higher-paying job opportunities. This bill would provide them with an incentive to become a teacher, giving students opportunity to learn from a teacher from a diverse background. Oregon primary and secondary education is changing. There are more students of color and low-income students today that need highly qualified teachers that send the message to students that America's opportunities are intended to benefit all citizens, regardless of their background. The National Teacher Recruitment Clearinghouse reports that many school districts have reported that there is a desperate need for teachers from diverse backgrounds to serve as language and cultural translators, to provide role models for students to help relieve the chronic teacher shortage, and prepare children to live and work in a multi-ethnic society. This bill ensures that people from educated, bright, and diverse backgrounds stay in Oregon to teach. Senate Bill 637 is critical in helping Oregon close the achievement gap, and the Oregon Students of Color Coalition asks me to pass it. Thank you for your time and consideration of this important issue.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Your testimony is very much appreciated. Ms. Lowe?
Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Margie Lowe. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. I want to speak to the Dash 3 amendments and thank the committee for those modifications. In our other programs that we administer, particularly in our scholarship programs, we oftentimes have donors who want to come forward and target a particular ethnic group. And because of recent Supreme Court decisions, our legal counsel is telling us that we have to be very careful in how we craft these different programs so that they don't exclude potential groups based on race and ethnicity. So by the amendments that I see in the bill, I don't think we'll have any of those difficulties in carrying out the direction and the intent of the committee.
Great. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, both of you. Senator Starr, would you, I'm going to wait and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 637 and open a work session now, Senator Starr, that you have a motion for me.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 637.
Senator Starr moves the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 637. Any discussion? Good work, Senator Deckert.
Thank you.
Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Starr?
Move that Senate Bill 637 is amended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 637 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I'll see that bill as soon as it gets there. All right, we are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill. We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 637. And see, she's so good. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 643.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 643 at this time allows state institutions of higher education to contract with financial institutions to provide student services. In your packet, you have the Dash 2 amendment. However, I know that Dawn's going to deliver the Dash 3 amendment that we received just at the beginning of the committee meeting. And I know that that was provided to us by the Student Association through the Senator Ringo's office. So.
Okay. Mr. Wyckoff, you're here. I've got George Fernsteiner, the Chancellor, Amanda Barron, Denise Wendler, I think, and Edward Kill. So you got two chairs. How about the Chancellor, and who else would you like to have come up with you? Yep, that's good. So tell me what's going on with this bill. It's been on again, off again, on again, off again. Explain who you are and give us the details.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm John Wyckoff. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Association, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'd like to just quickly run through what this bill does and then quickly explain the Dash 3 amendments. I know you're pressed for time and have a lot on your agenda, so I'll
be
brief. This bill was brought to us by the students to the OSA from by students in the student government at Portland State University and Southern Oregon University. It came about because their schools entered into a contract with a company called Hire One. What Hire One does is offer a service that changes the student body card to what they call the One card. It's basically a student body card that no longer uses your Social Security number as your student ID, but it also, along with the picture of the student, carries the MasterCard seal and can be activated by the student to be a debit card connected to a checking account. The original contract for with Hire One between SOU and PSU asked for the universities to provide of all students their Social Security number, birth date, and gender. While the universities did not actually do this, that was what the contract asked for.
Okay, that deserves repeating. Repeat that again, please.
The contract asked to provide the Social Security number, birth date, and gender of all students. The only service that Hire One offers that requires a Social Security number is a checking account, because the law requires that you have, I believe, a Social Security number when you open a checking account, as if I did with any other bank. PSU and Southern did not offer those, and through the process of creating this bill and working with us and us working with them and the Chancellor's Office, have both amended those contracts so that that would not be in the contract in the future. And you know, we appreciated that, but this bill seeks to make it so that such a contract cannot be written in the future, where Social Security numbers would be given out before the student opts into the checking account. That's the only point when it would be needed. The second thing this bill is seeking to do is to require disclosure when a student's personal information, such as gender and birth date, is given out. The bill you have in front of you, or the dash threes, require that the school disclose when they have given out your, or if they are going to give out your Social Security number coupled with gender, or your Social Security number coupled with date of birth. We would hope to we ask today that you pass this bill out that way, but would hope in the House to sort of decouple those. We need to work with all the parties involved to find a way that everyone can agree to do this. But at that part doesn't quite get to what we want, because it doesn't do very much, because at this point the universities would not be ever giving out in advance your Social Security number and birth date, especially should you move forward with this bill. But what we want is just essentially, if your birth date and gender are being given out, universities, when you enroll, or will say your birth date and gender may be given out for the following purposes. But this bill currently only does that if those pieces of information are given in tandem with your Social Security number. But to move this bill forward, and it is what everyone has agreed to, we think it's worth doing, because we still get the fundamental piece, which is protection of Social Security numbers, so that future contracts cannot be written that way. What the dash threes do, and where they are different from the dash twos, is the dash threes remove language that was part three of section one that simply said you could not make receiving a financial service like this checking account contingent on giving your Social Security number. That's a problem, because you have to give a Social Security number to receive a checking account, so we all agreed that that should be removed, and that is the only difference between the dash threes and the dash twos, is that removal. The last thing I would like to say is I would just like to thank and give credit to all the folks that have helped us put this together in a fairly collaborative process between the Oregon University system, the Chancellor, PSU, and Southern. We've all come together to get something we all agree on. Like I said, we hope to make part of it a little tougher in the House, but still think we can work towards something that everyone agrees on. It is also produced, and we think this is a positive outcome, the Chancellor agreeing to move forward with a comprehensive privacy policy that we will all work on, an administrative rule at the board level, and that's something that we have appreciated about this process as well. With that, I would simply ask that you pass out the dash threes today, and thank you, and we'll take any questions.
Okay, question for you. So you had this great work group and collaborative effort, but it's all down to a comma. Is that essentially what we're down to here?
Yes, we think so. Although there isn't agreement yet on what that comma would do and whether it should be there, so we need some more time to work through
that comma.
Okay. Second question is, I've been given authority by the Senate President to hold certain bills for future work that I need to. So it's your choice, Mr. Wyckoff. We can move this bill out today after we hear from the other parties, or I can hold this over, allow you to continue to work, and then we send over a bill that's completely ready in the House. It's your choice.
Madam Chair,
yes.
That puts me in somewhat of a difficult position in that I haven't discussed that. Last time I talked to all of the folks who have agreed on this, we said that it would be moving to the House. Do you need me to tell you right now?
Well, yeah.
Okay.
You know what? Mr. Wyckoff, I will hear from the other parties while you think about that. But I'm inclined
this
to just...
This is one of the people that I would need to discuss.
Well, then we'll hear from the Chancellor. Mr. Chancellor, you've lost your second tie.
Actually, Madam Chair, I do have it.
Okay.
I want to show it proudly.
All right.
It being Oregon State Day. For the record, George Kernsteiner, Acting Chancellor of Oregon University System. Birth date, June 14, 1948.
Wow.
And there are certain things when you get to this age you do disclose. And I want to thank John Wyckoff and the Oregon Student Association for bringing this forward. And the reason I want to thank him is because privacy is and is becoming an even more important issue throughout our society. One of the things that I fear, I think we all fear, is identity theft. And what that does to people who are subject to that, who become victims of that. This bill is a good step towards that. You adopted legislation in the last session that was a step towards that. But as John indicated, I want to have the opportunity to bring together students, faculty, staff, community members to try to look more comprehensively at privacy policy in the university system. Yes, this helps, and we support the Dash 3 amendments, but we're telling you we want to look at even more going forward, because I think it's going to be an even bigger issue for all of us throughout the society, and we want to take a look at it for our students, faculty, and staff.
Okay. Great. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I did have a bill last session that required removal of Social Security
yes.
numbers, and I got a little resistance on that, but then everyone came together except the insurance companies, and now they're having to do it anyway because of changes in federal law. So we are all very concerned about that. I remember at the hearing in Judiciary, I pulled out my ID card from the U of O, and it had my Social Security number proudly displayed on that. And I graduated in 1978, so that was a long time ago. All right, well, Mr. Wyckoff, we took the talk while the Chancellor was having a conversation with us. Do you want to just move the bill and work on it over there?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I think since that was the last agreement that we had reached with the folks involved, that would probably be the best way to go.
I think so, too. All right. Well, we will hear from the three other people signed up to testify, and thank you very much. Mr. Chancellor, thank you. Amanda Barron, Denise Wendler, and Edward Kill. Why don't you start on the left?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Barron, and I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm here today representing the students of Portland State University. I'd like to provide you with a brief context regarding SB 643. This bill is a response to the concerns of students across Oregon that contracts signed by two OUS schools with financial service company Higher One did not provide adequate protection of student privacy. At these schools, administrators signed contracts that explicitly mandate the release of Social Security numbers, dates of birth, and several other pieces of confidential student identity information. While the two OUS schools that have signed contracts with Higher One say they did not release Social Security numbers of all students, the fact that this is permissible and appeared in the contract was of great concern to students. This information is used by Horizon Capital Bank in Houston, Texas, for MasterCard debit cards connected to checking accounts marketed by Higher One to all students. Essentially, the card must be used as a student ID card and can be used as a check card to which financial aid dollars can be deposited. All of the actual banking services are provided by Horizon Capital Bank. The universities who sign with HireOne, they receive a cut for certain check card transactions. When students learned of the HireOne contract, we had several serious concerns. First, students were not included in the decision that would fundamentally change financial aid disbursement and market a specific bank's checking account and debit card service. Second, the contract with HireOne allowed Social Security numbers, dates of birth, and gender of each student to be given to HireOne before they chose whether they wanted to be HireOne customers. In cases where students requested confidentiality, information was still sent to HireOne. Students were later given an opt-out option of HireOne services. However, this opportunity was only offered after information had already been distributed to HireOne. Third, HireOne's website seemed unnecessarily confusing and cumbersome for students who wanted to opt out of the checking services, and it actually steered students toward the service. And fourth, HireOne, the fee structure of HireOne is higher than any of the banks, including fees to the customer for every purchase where a PIN number is entered. Originally, all students were mandated to set up customer accounts with HireOne, regardless of whether the customer account included the check card service. We were mandated because these MasterCard debit cards are the official student ID card. We had to activate our customer accounts, whether customers or not, with HireOne, if we wanted to use the library, the gym, or even to attend a class. For students such as myself who do not even receive financial aid from the university, the contract allowed our Social Security numbers to be given to the bank, and we were expected to activate our cards with HireOne and agree to the terms and conditions of HireOne and Horizon Capital Bank to use the card as a student ID. While PSU may not have given the Social Security numbers out in bulk to HireOne, the contract allowed for it. This was and continues to be a huge concern for students. Since students began working with the university on these issues, they have renegotiated the contract with HireOne. Administrators at PSU and SOU signed these contracts without input from students. We were never given the opportunity to say no. For many students, the experience of HireOne represented the lack of a collaborative process where there should have been one. It resulted in a contract that was overly permissive with student information. While we appreciate that campuses did not release the Social Security numbers of every student on campus to HireOne, that a contract allowing such an action was written is of great concern. Identity security is an important issue for students. Our status as students should not compromise our fundamental rights to privacy. And while we appreciate that PSU, SOU, and the university system have worked with us to amend the broad release of Social Security numbers out of the contract, we believe it should not be possible for this to happen again in the future. We further believe that students should be made aware fully and through full disclosure that such information is being released and for what purposes it is being released, and this bill does that as well. We also look forward to seeing the Chancellor's Office follow through on its commitment to create a new privacy policy in collaboration with students for the entire system through administrative rule. This experience led us to believe that this kind of comprehensive look is needed. Thank you very much for this opportunity, for allowing me to speak today, and your support of Senate Bill 643.
Thank you, Ms. Barone. And I would say that I think the Chancellor and the university system has been very responsive to your concerns, and that's why it's important for you to speak up when there are problems, and I think you've done a fine job doing that. So thank you for coming.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. We have Ms. Windler.
Senator Walker, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Denise Wendler, and I'm the Director of Business Affairs at Portland State University. I'd also like to disclose that I am OSU Class of 84, PSU Class of 03, in honor of OSU Day.
All right, great.
I'm here today representing President Bernstein and the university to convey our strong support for the Oregon Student Association and the Oregon University System for legislation that affirms the need to protect student Social Security numbers and student privacy in that area. We submitted written testimony, and therefore I'll strive to keep my comments brief. I know your time is limited.
That would be appreciated. Thank you.
The impetus of this legislation, we know, was the HireOne contract at PSU. And I want to take just a few moments to talk about that contract and also about the university's interest in providing services to students. The HireOne project was undertaken for three primary reasons. The first of those reasons was the student Social Security number privacy. Prior to HireOne, the student Social Security number was used as the student's official ID number, both for our interactions with the students and in all of our systems, and we recognize the need to move off of that to an alternate ID system. Secondly, the need to provide students with a streamlined access to their financial aid disbursements, recognizing that we're in a budget-constrained environment and that our enrollment is growing at a significant rate. And finally, the desire to provide students with increased options for financial aid disbursement above the two that were already offered. We recognize the concerns expressed by the students, and we've worked to make changes in response to those concerns. We've revised the contract, as Amanda stated, to remove the reference to Social Security number. The original contract had language that said, such as Social Security number, because at that time, that was the only number we had. We didn't have an alternate ID, and that contract has been amended. We've also been working with Higher One, as well as with other schools across the country, to redesign the activation website. We agree it was cumbersome. We agree it needed to be streamlined and clarified, and Higher One has been working with us to do that. And that's supposed to be hopefully deployed in the fall. We've established procedures for student involvement in the procurement process, the formal RFP process, the committee process, and I think that's a very positive outcome. And finally, we've given an option for students who feel very strongly to replace their Higher One card with a student university-issued ID card that looks very similar, but it does not bear the MasterCard logo on it, and it does not function or does not have the capability of functioning as a debit card, which is a choice. The results of the first two terms on Higher One at Portland State have been extremely positive. 57% of all students have gone online and activated their cards. That's over 15,700 students. Of those who have activated, 29% have selected their disbursement method as electronic deposit to their existing bank account or savings account. And 44% have elected to have a paper check. The difference now is that those checks are actually mailed to their home as opposed to them having to come to Neuberger Lobby to pick up those checks. 26% have actually opened a One account and are using those accounts. And finally, 141 students have elected to go for the alternate ID card, which is actually issued by the university but looks very similar. In the interest of brevity, I will stop there. I thank you for your opportunity to speak with you this afternoon, and I'd take any questions.
Well, you've been very thorough, Ms. Windler. I appreciate your comments. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Mr. Kill.
I'm Reverend Edward Kill. I'm a student at Portland State University.
Uh-huh.
And I'm here kind of ad hoc. I just heard about this today. The first thing I'd like to do is rebut some of the things Ms. Windler just said. She failed to mention that if you wish to opt out, you have to pay an extra $20, like the rest of the students. 59% may have signed up for this card, but that's only because they have financial aid, and they have to do it to get their financial aid. So they're over a barrel if it was. My information...
Can you pull the microphone over closer, sir? Thank you. Holy cow. We've got an Oregon State University reception at the door.
I did one.
It's not my fault.
Okay. All right.
Before I enrolled in Portland State, I checked out the privacy policy and the situation, and I was assured that all of my information would be in private. And just 2 months later, it was all shipped off to Connecticut. And I have been fighting this process ever since. I'm taking Mr. Bernstein to court. I'm taking Ms. Windler to court. I cannot believe that this is going on. I insist that this bill be passed as quickly as possible. My rights are being violated. My privacy has been violated. And what she failed to report was that they signed everybody up for a credit card. I have one right now at home, a MasterCharge credit card through Higher One. I never signed for it. I don't want it. I received a letter that says I'm liable for up to $500 on that card. I'm not involved with it, you know. They have done this to me. Pass this bill so they can't do this anymore.
Mr. Kill, your points were very well taken. Ms. Windler, would you please respond to the $20 opt-out cost?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair. The $20 fee is for any replacement card at the university, and it's designed to help cover the cost of replacement card. It's designed to cover card stock, labor, We charge it even if it's a higher one card being replaced. It's any time any type of an ID card is replaced at the university. The students that have opted out this past term, we recognize that some of them decided that they did not want the one card. They turned that in, and at that point we were issued an alternate ID card as a replacement. The university knew that this had not been planned for. We stepped up to the plate and absorbed half that cost for the students themselves.
You absorbed half the cost? Well, the normal, I appreciate that you stepped up to the plate, Ms. Wimmer, but I would have paid the entire cost if I was the university, because these students had not been given complete and accurate information about what this card would be used for, how the information, they didn't have a chance to opt out prior to getting the card. Is that true?
Chair Walker and members of the committee, the information they are issued to hire one card upon enrollment, that is correct. As far as the actual fees, a student attending Portland State now is charged $10 for a new ID card.
Okay, but my point is that did they have a choice to take a higher one card or another card at the time they enrolled?
Madam Chair, the higher one cards were the official card of the university. It was the one that was issued.
Okay, so my second point is, and I want you to take this back to the president of the university, is if these students don't want to hire one card, they should be able to get another card at no charge, because I find that very objectionable, that you're going to make them get this card, and if they don't want it, they got to pay $20. $20 is a lot of money to a college student.
We agree with that, ma'am.
All right. I would like you to take that back to the president, please.
May I respond to a couple other comments?
Yes, you may.
Thank you. I'm, first of all, not aware of any credit cards being issued through Higher One or any credit products being issued through Higher One. And I just want to make that statement in front of the committee. The cards that we have an optional debit card feature, but I'm not aware of any credit opportunity there. Regarding privacy, I would like the committee to understand also that the contract with Higher One was reviewed by Assistant Attorney General from the Department of Justice to make sure that the privacy provisions in that contract stipulated that the information that we gave to Higher One could not be released for purposes of marketing or to another company except to perform the function for which we had contracted.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any comments by the committee? Well, Mr. Kill, you have your rights and remedies in court. I encourage you to pursue those if you wish. And I thank everyone for their testimony today. And I will be sending a letter to Mr. Bernstein about, President Bernstein, about my request. All right. I think we'll close the public hearing on that. Thank you for coming and testifying. Close the public hearing on 643. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 643. And, colleagues, I did want to state that we have at our desk a letter or an information sheet from the trustee company who represents Higher One, going on about the virtues of Higher One. So I will allow you all to read that, and I'm sure the card is a good thing in its own way, and we've stumbled over a few problems, and the university system has stepped up to the plate. So now, Senator Starr, would you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move dash three amendments to Senate Bill 643.
Senator Starr moves the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 643. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 643 as amended to the Senate floor with the due path recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 643 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due path recommendation. Any discussion? Colleagues, I have understanding that they may amend this bill in the House, so we will let Mr. Wyckoff shepherd that around and move that forward. We will move this bill in good faith, no objections. Done. This bill is going to the Senate, and Senator Deckert, would you like to carry that?
Sure. You know, I was going to say George should buy all these PSU students dinner for getting him a new client for the Trester Company.
All right. Well, you are a chief sponsor on the bill, are you not? No, you're not. Okay. I think I added my name to the bill because I was so offended by it, what was going on. But anyway, you can carry this bill. All right. Thank you all for coming.
Great deal of reluctance there.
Okay, moving right along. It's 5 o'clock. We have an hour to go. Do you want to whip out these work sessions and a couple things? Probably not. Okay, I'm going to follow direction. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 747.
That's a big plan.
Zoom quick. Senate Bill 747. As printed, requires the State Board of Higher Education to establish uniform tuition at state institutions of higher ed for full-time students taking credit hours in a defined range. However, we have a dash one amendment from Senator Deckard's office, which replaces the original measure and requires the State Board of Education to review the long-term viability of state institutions of higher education. The bill, as printed, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And you know, Senator Deckard, I forgot what we were doing with this bill, so I'm going to have you hang tight for a minute. This bill originally was about the tuition plateau, and we promised to give the Student Association some moments to talk about that because it's an issue. The bill's not going anywhere with that that discussion, but I want them to have their day in the Senate. So could you just hang tight while those students come forward? I forgot about that. So I don't know who you want to bring up. Kevin Grant? Okay. All right. You know, I have these discussions with my committee administrator in the hallways, on the floor, and then sometimes when I get here, I kind of forget, and she gently reminded me. So, Mr. Grant, you have your day in the Senate. Please tell us about the original bill.
I will. Greetings and happy OSU Day, Chair Walker and members of the committee.
Go Beavs.
Thank you. My name is Kevin Grant, for the record. I'm a first-time testifier, long-time talker, unfortunately. And I am the State Affairs Director, officially. Sorry, it's been 2 hours. I know how you must feel.
That was good.
So I'm officially the Director of State Affairs for the Associated Students of Oregon State University. I represent OSU students in the Capitol. But even more broadly, I'm also an active board member for the Oregon Student Association. I represent over 100,000 students in the Oregon University system, as well as Oregon Health and Science University and Lane Community College, and hopefully Mount Hood Community College soon, too. And I'm here to support Senate Bill 747 as originally written. Senate Bill 747 would reinstate a system-wide tuition plateau. This establishes a full-time tuition rate policy for students enrolled in 12 to 18 credits for undergraduates and 9 to 16 credits for graduate students. First, I would like to offer you some history and perspective on the tuition plateau. The State Board of Higher Education first allowed universities to change their tuition policies away from the plateau in the winter of 2004, although a couple of schools did do it beforehand. Eastern Oregon University was the first institution to fully eliminate the plateau. Portland State University and the Oregon Institute of Technology were the next few universities to completely eliminate their system in fall of 2005. Each institution now determines their tuition policy, a tuition plateau policy, I have to say, instead of a system-wide one. The elimination of the tuition plateau, we believe, undermines the State Board of Higher Education's publicly stated goal of moving more students through a better education faster. We believe the data from two states, Minnesota and Missouri, shows that the removal of the plateau leads to smaller course loads by students, longer time to completion, and diminished revenue from fees to the universities resulting from the lower course loads. Please see the attached graphs in the back. Dr. J. Peter Zetterberg from the Office of Institutional Research and Reporting at the University of Minnesota has researched tuition plateaus and gave the following response when told about the decision by Oregon's institution to remove the plateau. He said, I quote, "I can think of no good reason to use a straight per credit tuition structure." That is referring to our policy decisions. Dr. Zetterberg speaks from experience. In the 4 years following the University of Minnesota's move to a plateau model, the average course load at Minnesota went from 12.8 to 14.2 credits, meaning that with the plateau, students were taking more credits, on average, 2 credits more. While that is an argument for the tuition plateau, I'd like to offer you a counter-argument from the other side on why the plateau might be a bad idea. The main argument is that tuition and fee income from universities may diminish. However, research at both the states has failed to validate that argument. And in some instances, student tuition and fee income actually increases with the plateau. Last year, we voiced our strong reservations about the potential negative effects to students of this policy change to the State Board of Higher Education. At that time, we said we believed removing the tuition plateau would create an obvious disincentive for students to take more than 12 credit hours. As we said then, we believe that this ran counter to the goals of more, better, and faster, stated by the State Board of Higher Education. And early results, preliminary results from Eastern Oregon University, have suggested that we are incorrect, and that this policy has created a significant drop in credit loads by students, causing many to increase the length of their education. At EOU, the number of students taking 12 credits between 2002 to 2004 has increased by about one-third, meaning more students are taking 12 credits. At the same time, there's been a 65% decrease in students taking more than 12 credits. There are a number of other facts here. I won't bore you too much by numbers that you're not going to understand by me saying anyway, but let's just say that because the tuition plateau has, you can read it on paper probably easier than understanding me, but basically the tuition plateau, the removal of that plateau has led to students taking less credits, usually keeping the minimum necessary to get financial aid, 12 credits. At Portland State University, we expected, because it's an urban commuter campus, that this effect would be muted. And we were correct. It was less severe as expected, but we did see that resident undergraduate students taking between 13 and 18 credits dropped by 358 students. Overall enrollment is up, and we're not going to say here that enrollment is not up. Obviously it is. However, the average carrying load has remained the same. Many students have cut back on courses, though. Students dropping course loads and adding terms, or even an academic year, which I have, I'll let you know, to their educational plan, take on all the other costs and lost income associated with more time in school. While EOU and PSU have been highlighted because they were two of the first to change their tuition policy, I'd like to take a minute to mention what has happened at OSU, Oregon State University, since the removal of the plateau a year ago, winter 2004. Once students found out about this this policy change, we sprang into action, holding forums and discussions with not just students, but faculty and administration, and we have found that there's overwhelming support for the tuition plateau from students and faculty. I can personally attest to the consequences of taking minimal course loads. Like I said, this is my fifth year, and I'm graduating to become a successful adult this spring after 5 years with a debt load of $24,000. Actually, over the last 5 years, I had kind of tried ignoring my student loans, but I decided to take a look at it. I found out that the student loan debt averaged about $16,000 to $17,000. I kind of wanted to see what mine would be compared to that, and it turned out to be $24,000. So I look forward to paying that off in the years to come.
For many years to come.
Many, many years to come, yes.
Especially if you consolidate and extend the payment period. I've been there with my children.
And especially if I consider, if I stay in public service, lobbying, that kind of stuff, I can see how it's going to take many years. We have found, I believe that any incentive that we can provide to allow students to receive their degrees faster will be more beneficial for them and for our economy as well. On behalf of students across Oregon, and in light of the evidence contained within this testimony, the OSA urges the committee and the legislature to take what has essentially been a finance-driven discussion and turn it into a student-driven discussion. This is what it's about. It's not about finances. This is about real people, real students at these schools. By reexamining a policy that has had and will continue to have lasting negative effects on students, meaning if we keep the tuition plateau out of our schools. In conclusion, the plateau removal undermines the State Board's own stated goals by giving students fewer choices, worsening their educational opportunities, and slowing their time to graduation. Again, quoting Dr. Zetterberg, the very best way for a low-income student to minimize the cost of his or her education is to graduate in a timely manner. This condition can be helped with a statewide tuition plateau policy in Senate Bill 747. Thank you for your time and allowing me to come forward today on this issue. I would greatly appreciate entertaining any questions, or you can meet me outside for the reception. Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee.
Yes, I'm getting rather hungry. Mr. Grant, your testimony was very well thought out. I want to commend you on your testimony.
Thank you.
I need to tell you, however, the bill cannot move in its current form. There's just not the political support to do that.
I know that means, yeah.
To be blunt about it. But here's my commitment to you. I think you have a valid point. The state board, the higher ed board, was totally redesigned. They sort of took a look at everything that they do, and they redesigned everything. Some of it I like, some of it I question, some of it I don't like. We have to give it time to work through. We'll come back here in 2007. If I'm still in the Legislative Assembly at that time, because, you know, the voters will say what they want to say and bring me back or not, I commit to you that I will bring this bill back in 2007. And we'll have a very long discussion about it if we find that it has really continued to play out in a difficult way, as you've indicated, at Eastern Oregon University with the drop in the students registering. You have valid concerns.
Thank you.
You truly do. And I really appreciate the way you presented the testimony. So I'll make that commitment to you. I expect the Student Association to track those numbers and to watch this issue over the next 2 years. And we'll see you back here in 2007 if it doesn't improve.
Thank you, Chair Walker and members of the committee. And I will make sure that I am personally here for that discussion in 2007.
I hope you're eating more than just ramen when you come back in 2007.
Try not to eat that stuff.
All right. Well, it's college food. All right. Any questions by the committee? Thank you very much, Mr. Grant. I appreciate your testimony. Now we will hear the amendments to this bill, which probably isn't going anywhere either. But Senator Decker and Chancellor Bernsteiner, I have no idea. Come on.
So we're 747.
I thought I'd get you a little excited.
Madam Chair, Ryan Decker, Senate District 14, before you have -1 amendments, which we have discussed many times before, what they do, and I'm going to try to be brief and to the point, they direct the State Board of Higher Education and the Chancellor's with me. I think they have some thoughts on this, but would like to work in accord with them and move something to the floor and then to the House if we're going to make minor adjustments to it.
Senator Decker, the Chancellor signed up as opposed.
Well, I'm going to let him.
That's the original bill.
The original bill. All right. Well, then that changes things. So continue, Senator.
Well, and thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is a relatively innocuous amendment, but it actually is pretty well thought out and actually has a great public purpose, and let me tell you why in 1 minute. If you look at the future of our higher education system, and I know we all agree, those of us who sit on this committee, have looked at the importance of higher education in a world economy where, obviously, land and labor are no longer our strategic advantage here in the United States, and so it really is our ability to innovate, and higher education, therefore, becomes so critical to this state and this nation's actually ability to compete in the world economy. And that asks us here in Oregon, because states are the drivers in higher education. The federal government plays a relatively minor role, or somewhat minor role. It asks us in the state to make the really tough, tough choices to ensure that we are delivering excellence and quality. And Madam Chair, you mentioned that we have a new Board of Higher Education. I think they are well positioned to take on some very tough questions, and that's what this amendment asks them to do. It asks them to look at the overall structure of our state system of higher education, and I would only use Washington as the comparator here, which we shouldn't always measure ourselves versus Washington, but they've taken a different approach on higher education, and they have 2/3 of the population that Oregon, or we have 2/3 of the population that the state of Washington has, yet they have one fewer university. The University of Washington garnered twice as much federal and private research dollars last year than all 7 of our institutions in total. They have that research money has obviously infused their economy and strengthened their economy in ways that we could only aspire to in many ways. And they've taken a different path of investment, and they invest more in their system of higher education, but they also have the ability to say no more with targeting their dollars on excellence and on achieving excellence. And I think that's the -1 amendment is in that spirit of how do you ask our state board, who's really the ones that you want, well, rather than the legislative body, to take on these tough questions of, here's the funding structure, and something Senator Starr and I sit down in revenue and look at on a daily basis is we, and a lot of folks don't know this, are third or now fourth in terms of federal health care transfer dollars. And so we have built this budget on a few factors. We all know the overdependence on the income tax, but we're also overly dependent on the lottery and federal health care transfer dollars, which we know, given the deficit and foreign engagements, the federal government is just going to, beginning yesterday, start clawing back on the federal dollars that they provide the state of Oregon. And so this Dash 1 amendment asks the State Board of Higher Ed to look at that. Look at the state contribution that's available. Look at the enrollment, the tuition rates, the faculty and staff, and really look at what is the sustainability of our higher education system. Are we structured properly to compete in this global economy? And to then put those recommendations into action. And where they need to report back and ask us to do something, it tells us then for them to do that. But whatever recommendations they could actually do themselves, similar to the ESD bill in terms of the State Board of Education taking on this tough one, I think this is a tough question that actually the State Board of Higher Education is well positioned to take on head on, and I know the Chancellor at least has voiced some interest in doing that, and this might just be a nudge in the right direction.
Thank you, Senator, and I was only teasing you because we have had a discussion about this bill at length, because you and I are of the same mind that we are thinning the soup, and I think this is a good opportunity for us to take a look at our resources. So with that, Chancellor, I put you on the spot in Ways and Means a couple of times about that question as well, so why don't you identify yourself once again and speak to the bill.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, George Bernsteiner, Acting Chancellor of Oregon University System, thank you for the opportunity to speak to the Dash Something Amendment.
Dash One.
Oh, good. I have spoken with Senator Deckard about these amendments, and I think we would craft them somewhat differently. But the spirit is similar, because one of the things that our state board intends to do is to take a look at long-range planning, and by that we mean 2025. And when you say 2025, it seems like a long way out there, but in fact, the graduate students we will have in 2025 are already in grade school today. So this is something that, in fact, we can plan for, we should plan for, we need to plan for as the economy and the state change. In doing that, the State Board will be taking a look at what they anticipate the needs to be around the state and in each area of the state. And that's one important thing, I think, that we have to look at is every corner of Oregon and not just the state as a whole. And as we do that, then, we have to look at what programs we offer, academic programs we offer, what resources we have at each of our institutions and how they are positioned to meet the needs of the state. We are in a situation where we understand that for about 15 years there has been a reduction of state support for higher education, I think, in all but one legislative session. And the reason for that is pretty clear. I mean, you all know it. We went through a major change in our ability to move monies in the state due to Measure 5, and one of the fallouts from that has been the reduction of support for higher education. As we look into the future, as we look at what is sustainable for Oregon, both in terms of our current programs and institutions and in terms of what we may need for the future, the spirit of the Dash 1 amendments, which we would hope to work different language out, in fact is the spirit in which the board intends to undertake that long-range planning work. So I think it fits very well with the intention of the board, and I think that we can work language out that will be satisfactory.
Thank you, Chancellor. Any questions?
I agree with you. How about that?
All right. Well, I appreciate your testimony. We just have one other person signed up to testify, and I'm not sure if it's on the original bill or the amended bill. Lethan Graves Highsmith?
No.
Not testifying? All right. Great. Thank you.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 747. We will open a work session on Senate Bill 747. Senator Starr?
Madam Chair, there seems that there is still some problem with this language between the two witnesses. Are we desiring to move this amended bill as is, or are we going to work on it?
Senator Starr, my preference would be, I talked to the Chancellor earlier today. If there's some massaging, I'm very open and want to be helpful to the State Board in the conversation they want to have. So I would work closely on this with the Chancellor and would like to do that in the House, given the timelines we're under.
With that explanation, then I move the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 747, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr. I appreciate your attention to detail. Senator Starr has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 747. Any objection or any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Starr?
Having replaced the bill with the -1 amendments, are we still going to Ways and Means?
No, Senator Starr. Let's ask the Chancellor. Chancellor, this is a completely different bill. The only reason it would go to Ways and Means is it says the State Board of Higher Education shall review the long-term viability of the state institutions of higher education. Will that cause a fiscal?
Madam Chair, of course it will cause a fiscal. However, that's something the State Board was intending to do anyway. So I think in this particular case, you probably don't need to do that.
Okay. That's an answer that's good enough for me. Thank you very much.
Well, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 747 as amended to the floor with the stipulation that the President allows us to remove the referral.
All right. Sounds good.
With the due pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 747 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation with stipulation that the Senate President will allow us to, remove the referral to Ways and Means. Any discussion? No. You're talking out of school over there. Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Deckert, you got another one today. That's what happens when you come to committees. Yes, you've been very good and busy. All right, great. Well, colleagues, we're going to switch gears and punch out these work session bills because they're only going to take about 5 minutes, and then we're going to devote the last half hour very quickly to 342, and then we'll have time for 684. So we're going to go into a work session on Senate Bill 769.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, 769 was last heard on the evening of March 28th. As you remember, this is the former Senate Bill 10, and it changes the residency requirements for the purpose of determining tuition and fees at institutions of higher education. We do not have amendments to this measure. However, today we did receive a revised fiscal impact from the Legislative Fiscal Office. It is in your packet, and you'll notice on the second page that there appears to be a fiscal impact. Again, this measure does not currently have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, you might want to make note of that fiscal impact. And we do have response to questions that were raised at the previous hearing from Dave McDonald, who is here in the audience if you have additional questions. And that's about it.
Thank you for the questions.
And if I can do it, we've got an emergency.
Okay. All right. So, colleagues, have you had a chance to review the responses to the questions? Are you satisfied with the answers? I know, Senator Cruz, I don't think you support the underlying bill. At least that was my interpretation the other day from our conversation.
That's correct, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, with this revised fiscal, if it needs to go to Ways and Means.
Well, I'm trying to find my copy of the fiscal, and Marjorie can get that for me here. LFO would also expect approximately 20% of these students would have enrolled without the provisions of the bill, and the remaining 80% would be new students who would not have otherwise enrolled if resident tuition rates were unavailable to them. If this expectation is correct, the department would receive an additional $170,000 of tuition and fee revenue per year, but incur additional costs of approximately $630,000 per year. The net impact would be equivalent to a funding reduction of $460,000 in the 05-07 biennium and a reduction of $920,000 in the 07-09 biennium. This is all rather interesting. I don't think there was this kind of a fiscal impact last session on this very same exact bill. My preference would be to move it to the floor, and if the Senate President would like to acknowledge that fiscal impact statement, he has the prerogative to send it to Ways and Means. How's that sound?
Sounds fine.
Does that work?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you need the dash one?
No, we have no amendments.
We have no amendments to this bill, and we had a very good hearing on this bill. I understand there were folks who were upset about it. There were folks who really supported it. There was concern about the immigration laws and whether we were in compliance with Section 105 or 805, excuse me. I believe that's a discussion for another day. Legislative Council indicated we were in compliance, according to their belief. I understand this has been brought up in the state of Kansas and is under court review. A decision is expected in May. Well, we're going to still be here in May. So if that's the issue, we'll hear about it if this bill makes it over to the House. So, colleagues, I would like an amendment a motion from Senator Starr, if I could.
Madam Chair, as you know, I told you I'm conflicted on this issue. I have supported this because I feel that those students have been in our system. They're not going home, even though they're living here illegally. They have must, by their indication that they are seeking citizenship, they will not have an opportunity to be the productive citizens they would like to be. I'm going to anger many of my friends by moving this bill, but I'm going to do so, and because I feel that these students have been and will continue to make a contribution to our society, and the better they're educated, the better opportunity they will have to do so. So with all of that explanation, I move Senate Bill 769 to the floor for the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr, I admire you a great deal. I respect you, and I appreciate that commentary, and I appreciate that motion. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 769 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. We are in discussion. I see Mr. Bender's in the back of the room. Did you want to comment on the fiscal? Is that why you're here?
If you have any questions,
I'm sure I'd like to find out why,
okay,
if
Mr.
indeed
Bender,
it's different, why it is.
Could you come forward, please? I'm glad you listened in. I thought we were oblivious to everyone in the world, but those of you who work very hard in LFO. So please identify yourself and explain this fiscal, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I am Steve Bender with the Legislative Fiscal Office. And you are correct. This fiscal impact is somewhat different than how it appeared when the same bill was up last session. The fiscal impact, or the additional costs to the university system, are actually lower now than when we estimated this 2 years ago. And that is primarily due to the fact that we now have additional information on how these types of similar programs are working in other states. And we have tried to estimate and to project how many students would be affected here in Oregon based upon experience in other states. We do note that, as your committee administrator had mentioned, as you read, this would have an impact, we believe, on the fiscal situation for the Department of Higher Education. And I'm sure that, speaking on behalf of the Legislative Fiscal Office, these are types of issues that we think are important that the Ways and Means Committee has an opportunity to look at as they're looking at tuition issues and putting together a budget for the Department of Higher Education.
Thank you. Senator Cruz, does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much, Madam Chair. I guess I would say, you know, and we depend on LFO to give us numbers, and I guess I would point out that last session, Senate Bill 1 had a huge fiscal on it, and this session it had none, and we accepted that. And so I'm wondering why we wouldn't accept this. It's in the same spirit.
Madam Chair, I'm fine sending this down to Ways and Means. I think it's a good subcommittee that we get it.
I would amend my motion, Madam Chair, with your permission, to send this to the Committee on Ways and Means instead of the floor.
Well, Senator Starr, I was going to allow it to go to the floor and allow the president to make that determination by having the president have a discussion with LFO. And if he didn't agree with LFO, he could move it to the floor or move it back down here for the referral. But I'm willing to go with what my committee wants to do. So what do you all want to do? You want to move it to the president's office and let him decide?
Madam Chair, I'm fine either way. I think either route gets you there, but I think the subcommittee that you serve on would be a good subcommittee to handle this question, too.
Okay, great. Then I will take that. Then Senator Starr, did you revise your motion to go to Ways and Means?
Yes, Madam Chair, with your permission, I did so.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 769, as is, to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, and a very good due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I will be a no on it.
All right.
Sure.
Understood. Any objection? Hearing none. Ms. Tuso, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Deckard?
Aye.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Warren
Fett? Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 769, having received the constitutional majority, is sent to Ways and Means. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing or the work session on Senate Bill 769. We're going to open a work session. Please be quiet as you exit. We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 766. Ms. Taylor?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Senate Bill 766, we heard actually on Monday, and that is the measure that would limit the amount of salary and benefits that a school district, ESD, or a charter school would be able to pay the administrator at the end of the contract. We did have amendments, and I'm looking for them right now. I believe they were the dash ones.
Here you go.
Thank you. Okay, those were the dash ones, and we had a bit of discussion on Monday, as you remember. I believe that Trisha Smith and John Marshall are here if you want to continue that discussion.
I actually don't think we need any further discussion. Let me explain. We had quite a discussion on the dash ones. On Monday, Mr. Marshall did not agree with those. I asked the parties to see if they could resolve their differences. They could not. So I'm prepared to move the bill as is. I think it's a good bill. I thought that we attempted to address the issues that Mr. Marshall and Mr. Bennett raised at the first hearing. I think we have something that we can be proud of here because we want to get more money in the classroom and we want to be very careful about where it goes when it's not going to our kids. So this is an attempt to end these golden parachutes. Senator Starr, would you have a motion for me?
Madam Chair, I am really conflicted with this bill. I'm not going to be able to support it.
Okay, then we are going to hold off until Senator Morissette returns. So I'm going to recess the work session on Senate Bill 766. Yeah, I need him. Okay, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 748.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 748 directs the Department of Ed to prepare a financial education program and allows districts to implement that financial education program.
I need you for a vote right now. And where did Senator Deckard go? I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 748 for the moment. And we will stand at ease.
You can't let these kids out of your sight.
I know. They like it.
Okay, and again, as I stated, Senate Bill 748 directs the Department of Ed to prepare financial education programs and allows districts to implement those programs. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you, colleagues. This is the financial education bill that we heard earlier that you all seem to be excited about. It goes to Ways and Means. I serve on that committee. I'd like your support to get it down there so we can talk about it, but I really don't know why there's a fiscal on this bill. Do we have someone from the Department of Education here?
Yeah.
Can you come forward, please? And do you have the fiscal? We don't have a fiscal impact on this?
No, but we're anticipating.
But we're anticipating a fiscal. So state your name, please, and why you think there's a fiscal.
Madam Chair, I'm Andrea Morgan. I'm the curriculum specialist for the Department of Education. And the reason that there is a fiscal expected on this is while we've heard lots of testimony earlier in an earlier hearing about all the programs that are available, that is exactly the problem with it, that we need to be able to examine these programs. A couple years ago, the chair of the Federal Reserve, Greenspan, stated that there was a crisis in financial education, and I think we all agree that we need to have more of that. But at the same time, it also encouraged almost every single financial institution in the country and other organizations to provide curriculums for this very purpose. Some of them are very, very good, and some of them are not exactly, I think, what we would like to see in our classrooms, because many of them use them as an opportunity to advertise. And so they are littered with corporate logos. They are full of things that maybe aren't exactly what we are hoping to teach. For instance, some of them are very good at making students good consumers and customers for their institutions, but maybe don't get at the very issues that we have concerns about when we talk about the need for financial education.
Thank you, Ms. Morgan. We heard that before. Let me ask you a question. I understand that the department has reviewed one of the programs already. How long did that take you to do that?
There were three of us that were working on that project because we wanted to look at it in terms of the alignment to the social sciences standards and our mathematics standards. And it took a considerable number of hours because it was a curriculum that was written at a number of grade levels. So we wanted to make sure that it really did match with our social studies and our math standards, and that we weren't asking students, for instance, in this case, we found that it was written for another state's standards. And so it was asking students at one grade level to do math that was at full 3 to 4 years below our standard expectations here in Oregon. So it really didn't fit with what we were trying to accomplish in our math standards. And so it took some time to take it apart, to look at what they were offering, and to make sure that it met our standards and our expectations.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Morgan. I'm going to recess the work session on Senate Bill 748 because I've got a quorum again. I'm going to open the public hearing on, or the work session for crying out loud, on this bill that I thought was moving. Senate Bill 766. Thank you.
The first one.
can you get?
I would very much like the dash one.
Madam Chair, given what the Vice Chair's comments on this, I will move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 766.
Thank you. Senator Deckert moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 766. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Next motion.
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill 766 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Deckert moves the Senate Bill 766 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Yes.
Oh, well, we'll get to that when you vote.
Well, you asked for it.
I got that part. All right, well, we're going to win round one. Don, can you call the roll, please?
Senator Deckert. Aye.
Senator
Cruz.
No.
Senator Morrissey.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Stern?
No.
Chair Walker? Aye. Senate Bill 766, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. I will carry this bill. Okay, now we're going to go back to reopen a work session on Senate Bill 748. We got an explanation. It's going to take all this great deal of time to examine these programs. So we're going to send this bill to Ways and Means. Senator Starr, do you have a motion?
Yes. Madam Chair, without amendment?
Yes, that's correct.
I would move to send Senate Bill 748 to Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Senator Starr. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 748 to the Committee on Ways and Means. With any kind of a recommendation there, Senator Starr?
Well, I'd like to see it passed, yes.
Okay. I appreciate that. That would be with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? The discussion would be I'm going to have a real interesting conversation in Ways and Means. I'll tell you that, colleagues. So no further discussion. So ordered on the... Did we just vote on an amendment? We just sent it to Ways and Means.
Close
the work session. My God, we're getting goofy. Yeah, okay, we got all those bills done. So now we're going to quickly hear open a public hearing on Senate Bill 342. Do we need a public hearing? I thought we heard that. Aren't we just moving the darn thing?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 342, you have the dash 2 amendment that replaces the original measures. You heard this is the course numbering bill, the Senator Courtney, Senator Schrader, and I believe there was a House bill, course numbering. I believe that Chancellor Flynn is here.
Okay. And Senator Morissette, you have to go. I don't necessarily need your votes anymore, and I appreciate you staying. I know it's a hardship for you tonight. Thank you. Okay, Senate Bill 342, Chancellor Pernsteiner and Bob Turner, I believe. Thanks for hanging with us.
Thank you for having us.
I'm feeling like we're getting a short end of the stick on this. I might have to see what we're going to do next. But anyway...
Well, Chair Walker, members of the committee, for the record, George Bernsteiner, acting chancellor of Oregon University System, joined today by Bob Turner, the president of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, and biology professor at Western Oregon University. Very quickly, we had the opportunity to meet with Senator Schrader and representatives of the community colleges, and what you have before you is a consensus of all of the work of a lot of people at the universities and the community colleges with Senator Schrader's office in order to help achieve better transferability of credits and help achieve better advising of students. And I don't think I need to say more than that unless you have questions.
Hallelujah. That's what I have to say about it.
For the record, my name is Bob Turner, and as Dr. George Bernsteiner just said, I'm president of IFS, and what he said.
What he said. Okay.
I would like to emphasize a couple of things about the process and the bill. Number one, there was a lot of collaboration among the constituents that brought these amendments together, particularly the community college and the OUS faculty members. And I would also like to emphasize the importance of the online degree auditing system that is mentioned in a couple of lines in this bill. I've seen it demonstrated a couple of times, and that would be a very powerful tool to make available to students to be able to take the courses that they have taken, no matter where they took them, and look and see what that would mean toward their progress toward any degree at any institution.
and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Turner, and I appreciate that Senator Schrader moved forward and worked with you all on this bill, because I thought you were all doing some really good stuff, and it's not a very definitive word, stuff, but you all know what I mean, and it is a technical term, and so I appreciate that you could all get together and resolve this matter. Any other questions?
Comment, Madam Chair. I appreciate the ongoing work between the universities and our community colleges and how they are working to align coursework and move toward a degree-granting program that allows completion even on community college campuses. I think it's great work going forward. Having been shooty on the state board from Chemeketa adds a real power to that, I believe, and so I'm real hopeful that work continues and accelerates. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I move the dash two.
I got you today. Awesome. Usually you're getting me. Okay, I just closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 342, and I want to thank our guests for testifying. I'm going to open the work session now, Senator Starr.
I'm going to move the dash two amendment, Senate Bill 342, Madam Chair.
To the floor. Okay. Oh, dash two. Yeah, right. Senator Starr moves the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 342. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator Starr.
Yes, I move Senate Bill 342 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 342 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation as amended. Thank you. Any discussion? Hearing none. Any objection? Hearing none. So ordered. We're going to give this bill to Senator Schrader. We're done.
Well, that means you'll have to vote for it, won't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He'll be an aye instead of a no. Poor Senator Schrader. We tease him far too much. All right. We are closing the work session on Senate Bill 342. So we have one more bill. Senate Bill 684. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 684. We only have two folks signed up, but Senator Starr, this is your bill. Would you like to talk about it before we have testimony?
That I would. And,
okay.
I'll just do that from here.
All right.
Save us a moment's time. The concept that I'm bringing forward in Senate Bill 684, Madam Chair, is I am State Senator Charles Starr, and
very good.
I've been very concerned over the years that we are behind the curve with other states in providing qualifying legislation in our statutes for virtual schools. Many other states are way ahead of us, and I understand now over 90,000 students are attending virtual schools in California. Idaho has statewide virtual schools, 3 years old now. Ohio's virtual school called ECOT, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow, was first chartered in April of 2000. These schools are able to deliver a personalized program of instruction to students who are being underserved in the public system. They found that in the Ohio charter that most of the students were from both ends of the bell curve. They also were able to serve young mothers who had to work to support their child, who were able to go to school 24/7, complete their high school education, and go into higher ed. I think it's an important step forward, and that we provide some direction in our statutes for virtual schools, I think is truly important, and it's something that's certainly going to be important in the future of education in our state. And I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Starr. I appreciate your comments and your explanation. I know you've talked about that throughout the session. I'll bring up Tim King and Karen Hikas, who are the only two signed up to testify. One's for and one's against. So there we go. Yin and yang. So why don't we have Mr. King testify first since he's in support of the bill?
Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, I thank you for this opportunity. I am indeed in support of the bill because, my name is Tim King. Sorry. And I'm currently the principal of the Clackamas Web Academy, where we're doing this very thing. I am also an administrator in the North Clackamas School District. I want to say, first of all, that I do not believe all students should be educated in a virtual manner. I don't think it's necessarily the best thing for all students. It is very clearly, however, the best thing for some students, and it does, in fact, fit a niche. And we are currently meeting that niche, and we need just a little bit more help, and this bill would help provide that. The student population at our virtual school tends to be one of not just the classic homeschoolers, which a lot of people think is one of the current needs for this, but we have a fair number of pregnant young ladies, a fair number of teen mothers. We have a relatively large portion of young people who have to work for one reason or another, and this allows them to go to school and still work in support of their families. And then probably our biggest growing section of student population of our 185 students are the students on 504s who have access difficulties with the school in one manner or another.
Mr. King, did you say you have 185 students?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. We are currently operating as an alternative school in the North Clackamas School District. And what we would like to be able to do is operate as a charter in the North Clackamas School District. That charter has already been written. We're up and ready to go with it. Parties have already agreed on it. And we'd like to be able to operate as a charter. One of the reasons for that is the charter solves a lot of issues for us right off the bat that we're having real difficulty with as an alternative school. In particular, is the funding. One of the big issues for us right now is we've applied for and received the state grant for the state planning grant for charter schools to do this. And of course, until you actually get a charter, then you can't move on to the next section of the grant money. And so for us, it's a big deal in terms of just getting more development money. Also, it's a big deal because there are some issues that get resolved. Special ed is not easily spelled out with an alternative school, especially for young people who are coming from other districts to us. And we've had a fair amount of support from the surrounding districts to us because of the nature of the population that we serve. However, each one of those has a different in-district transfer policy for us. And so special education becomes a real issue as to who's handling it and who's not handling it, who's getting the extra weight. And that's become a real problem. It'd be a lot easier, since the charter laws are a little more spelled out in that regard, if we were in fact a charter. The other issue that you would think wouldn't be as big a deal, but it really is athletics. Is a student allowed to participate, and where are they allowed to participate? With the charter system, it's pretty easy. With the alternative school system, where in fact you've transferred a kid in, it's a little bit more difficult as to where they're going to be able to participate. Do they get to participate at their district boundary school, or do they get to participate in the North Clackamas School District as a result of transferring in? And if so, what school? And so that has created a number of difficulties for us. The other issue is one of the diploma and offering the diploma as an alternative school that is relatively more complicated. And the nature of the diploma is a little bit different. Now, we're still a North Clackamas School District school, which means that we still have all the regulations that a North Clackamas School District school would have, whether we were a charter or not, as part of our our charter that we would still meet all the North Clackamas School District graduation requirements, but we do change them in terms of what we call them and how we meet those same requirements, and that's by agreement with the district. So the spirit of what we're trying to do is exactly the same. We just want to be able to do it in the student's home as opposed to having the student come in. One little side note that has come from all this work is we have, in fact, also developed e-schools in each of the three high schools of the North Clackamas School District, which have been exceptionally effective in bringing in dropouts. And for us, that has also been just a big thing, and we've been real pleased with that as a spinoff to what the work we're doing in the Clackamas Web Academy. That's an addition to it.
Thank you. Senator Starr, did you have a question?
No.
Oh, okay. All right, Ms. Hikas?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I hope that I check neutral on this bill and not against.
Well, actually,
you did
check neutral. I'm sorry.
Thank
I apologize.
You. It's okay. I know it's late. I just wanted to go on record. I have a lot of respect for Mr. King and what I know of his programs.
All right.
And I just wanted to start by thanking Senator Starr for his commitment to options for students and to flexibility for charter schools in Oregon. I do want to say that, first of all, my name is Karen Hikas. I'm with the Charter School Development Center, and I run the Oregon office of the Charter School Development Center, who has been providing technical assistance and policy support for about 13 years throughout the country. And I do want to say that I'm neutral on this bill, and virtual education is a huge issue, of course. And my understanding is the State Board of Education is studying this issue and kind of trying to make some decisions about how to deal with that across the state within regular schools. I do want to say that in its current form, this bill for charter schools and just kind of broadly allowing charter schools to be virtual schools, I can't support that, and charter schools development center can't support that, because we believe that the bill doesn't address the core policy issues, which are, number one, does Oregon allow and or support non-site-based charter schools and non-site-based instruction in charter schools? And number two, does Oregon allow and or welcome education management organizations or for-profit organizations running and operating our charter schools? I believe that our law, is unclear on both of those issues, and I think both of those issues do need to be clarified. And I would be more than happy to participate in those discussions. As Senator Starr mentioned, California and many other states do have a large number of non-site-based charter schools, and I have a lot of colleagues in California in the charter school arena, and California has a very complex set of regulations that regulate their non-site-based charter schools, and I wouldn't recommend replicating that system because it's very complicated. However, I think if we are going to have non-site-based charter schools, we do need to have some regulations and define what virtual school means, define what remote setting means. We need to ensure accountability and ensure comprehensive education and professional educator direction over the curriculum and issues like that. I also note that the bill provides for a computer and an internet connection, tools to access technology and information, and those tools neither ensure nor block access to a comprehensive education. They're just the tools. So I would encourage you to continue to analyze this issue of virtual education and the policy issues that I talked about, whether Oregon will allow and support non-site-based charter school instruction, and whether or not we will allow or welcome education management organizations running our charter schools. And I would welcome any questions.
How do you know the State Board is working on this issue?
Well, I attended a hearing that they had maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago up in Portland at the Multnomah ESD. Tim King was there as well. And the hearing was explicitly about virtual education in Oregon and who some of the providers are through ESDs and universities and so forth. And I understand through talking with several people at the Department of Education that that the State Board is definitely looking at virtual education as an issue. The other issue that I didn't mention mention that you may or may not be aware of is that we did have a charter school in Oregon that was, well, we had a proposed charter school that was supported by a superintendent and a charter that was approved for a statewide virtual charter school and for homeschoolers, essentially. And the Department of Ed denied ADM weight to that charter school. And there's currently a lawsuit between that district and ODE regarding that issue. There were a couple other grounds that the state used to deny ADM weight. There's another school right now in the same situation who also has passed and approved a district statewide virtual school. And it's yet to be seen. No one's seen a copy of that charter at the state that I'm aware of, at least as of Friday, and they're trying to determine whether to give that school ADM weight. So there are definitely some you know, things going on around the state in this issue. Excuse me?
The issue is boiling up because
yes,
we already are offering classes through our public schools, through our community colleges, through our universities, online. And it's an issue we need to deal with, and I'm hopeful that the department will continue to develop the concept and work to bring about the kinds of directions that provides accountability at the same time provides great freedom, because I think that's the only way through parental choice that we're going to be able to get some measure of control on the rising costs of education. We cannot continue on the path we're on.
Mm-hmm.
We're soon bankrupt if we do.
Senator Starr, what I'd like to do as a courtesy to you is I have a meeting with the Senate President on Monday to tell him which bills I'd like to hold over and perhaps continue work on. I'd like to hold this bill over and get some information from the department and the Board of Education and see where they're at on this, have them have a conversation with you and with me, and if they're ready to roll, you know, we can work with this bill. If they need more time to discuss the issue, we may have to wait a while on it. But would you appreciate that?
I would very much appreciate that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Because they're not here signed up to testify, and I think we need to have some questions answered. We've both presented some good testimony and raised some good questions. So I think that's what we're going to do. So thank you, Mr. King.
Thank you for your time.
I close the public hearing on Senate Bill 684. I think that completes our business. We've had a heck of a ride today, colleagues.
Timing is
everything. All right. Thank you very much. You know, we are, let me say that I don't think we're going to have a committee meeting on Monday. We will let you know tomorrow because we only have two House bills. We only have two House bills in our committee, and we're done with Senate bills for the moment. So
next Friday.
But next Friday we have our field trip to Eugene. So actually, you know what? We aren't going to have a committee hearing on Monday because we're doing it on Friday. So you know what? We're meeting on Wednesday and Friday next week. Thank you very much, colleagues. I appreciate your attendance. We are adjourned.